welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 242. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today is James Jones.
As always.
Greg Leahy is back.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And John is out on vacation this week. He's actually visiting lovely Gulf Shores, Alabama, a place I've spent plenty of time growing up. It's a nice place. It's the beach.
You don't take vacation from RFN. It takes vacation from you.
Same thing.
You bald bastard.
But substituting for him this week, we have our old friend, Michael TYP Cole.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good show. Sorry, I'm trying to do John again.
You might be overselling this a little bit.
So someone recently asked me what TYP stands for. Mike, I'm sure you've told this before.
I have told this before on this podcast.
Like 200 episodes ago.
It stands for the younger plumber. Because my alter ego AS is Luigi in some of, not so much in the forms. I used to have a form icon that was Luigi, but I used this pseudonym because when I joined staff, there were already like four Mikes on staff. So going by Mike was kind of confusing. So I think I just call me Younger Plumber.
So anyway, we are looking forward to a great show this week. And actually, Greg, since you were gone last week watching the draft.
Well, before we begin, I did want to take a moment to say that actually I found last weekend to be quite uplifting. I know it's probably more fashionable to say, oh, well, you know, what does it matter? But I quite enjoyed watching everyone get ready with their red, white, and blue regalia and all the pageantry for the joyous union of Alabama defensive tackle Marcel Darius and the Buffalo Bills. You know, the draft's one of those things where it's fun to get excited about it, but in the end, no one knows how well this player is going to turn out.
Especially when there might not be a season the following
year.
Were you disappointed they didn't get Cam?
Buddy Nix, our general manager, who is far more southern sounding than even the 18-year-old Johnny, is...
I was 19.
Sounds like he was pretty disappointed, actually, which is unusually candid, kind of seemed to make it clear that they would have taken him if he was there.
To be fair, if your last name ends in X, or your first name is Buddy, really, you're probably from the South. If it's both... You're pretty much locked up from being south of, say, North Carolina.
Well, you know, I was a little surprised that he went number one, but it sounds like it was a fairly controversial decision. Maybe not so much because the Panthers don't need him, but because I guess they didn't have a great draft otherwise to...
Because they needed everything else, too.
Yeah. But they will sell plenty of tickets with him. I mean, especially being in the South, they'll raise the prices and they'll still sell out. So, anyway, Greg, what you been playing?
Yep. So the past couple of weeks, I've played a little of a lot, if you know what I mean. I did actually start Final Fantasy 3/6 on the virtual console,
nice.
But I have not really got very far other than say that the music's very pretty, isn't it?
You know, this is a game that's been on my radar for a really long time, and I was kind of pissed because I started listening to a recent Retronauts where they start talking about things, and yes, they were spoiling things. I'm like, God damn it, so I had to stop listening. They already spoiled
too much.
Yeah.
It's still not out in America for virtual console.
It's crazy.
I've got 800 points literally just drooling for Final Fantasy III, so...
/6.
I've been waiting like 2 months since I found out that it was probably coming. And instead we got Rival Turf.
Yeah, what the hell?
Yeah!
Jellicoe Brawlers.
Oh, I love Jellicoe, so you shut the hell up.
Yeah, actually, if they're bringing out stuff...
I have racist Mega Man from Jellicoe, thank you.
I mean, I would totally love Pinball Quest, and I think that was a Jellicoe game, so...
Hey, I would buy Pinball Quest.
Yeah.
So, actually, Greg, I kind of like to get your reaction to the intro, because it's been a long-ass time since I played FF6, but I recall that the intro it's kind of meant to make this really interesting first impression.
Well, it is interesting, because it just kind of throws you in there. I mean, there's a little bit of prologue text, so it's very much kind of the Star Wars school, you know, episode 4, of just, like, it's happening now.
This shit is real.
The very first thing you see the three soldiers in their mech suits... Trodging through the snow. It's not even a word, trodging. They're walking through the snow, and it's very cold and kind of this stark environment, and they're talking about their mission, and then they go into this mountain sort of winter town and do some messed up stuff.
Yeah, and you're kind of not really clear, you know, if you are one of them or all of them, or, you know, what kind of perspective the story's going to go from once you get past that scene or whatever. So it was an interesting kind of beginning to an RPG or any kind of sort of action adventure game with a kind of epic scope that, you know, but normally it's the humble lad in his family home, you know, waking up or something and everything's idyllic and then things go bad or he's forced out into the world, rather just, as I said, like Star Wars just gets going. And I've just kind of played a little bit past that very, very first part. It'll be a lot longer term kind of project than, you know, stuff like Chrono Trigger was in some ways, because it's on Virtual Console. I won't be able to just dip into it as much at will as you can with something portable. So it'd probably take me a good long while to work through it, maybe. I would still hope it would be quicker than John's accelerating, but still kind of preposterously slow.
Real-time version of Chrono Trigger.
So you're playing this on your European Wii. Is it the European version of the game?
There was no European version.
Ah, so this is a good, clean cut.
Yeah, so that's a mercy, because it means that you do have to pay another 100 points. It's a 900-point game. But that does mean that it is it's literally the same ROM as in America, so it's 60Hz 480p.
Very good.
You're playing the American version, and they still haven't given us the American version.
Indeed.
Here in America.
Well, I mean, it's the Chrono Trigger scenario. We're going to get Chrono Trigger soon, but we're getting it last, probably.
But, you know, that'll be something I'll be chipping away at here there for quite a while. Another thing, actually, I picked up a copy of one of James' favorite DS games, Infinite Space.
Woo!
Which is that will be a long-term project, because
it's infinite.
James is very fond of using the word infinite in his review when it is not capitalized. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
in terms of the scope and the
well,
size.
Well, I mean, it was deliberate, but
I know.
But, yeah, it's well-earned.
It is expansive, shall we say. So that's going to be another long-term kind of project. But it was just, I've been interested in pretty much everything that Platinum's put out, mainly because Beautiful Joe, when they were Clover, is one of my absolute favorite games of that generation. We'll return to that topic later in the show. And Okami as well, I like that a lot. So everything they've done as Platinum in the post-Clover year, I've had an eye on. But, you know, I bought Mad World, but I didn't end up playing it because the PAL version was sodomized.
Yeah.
And Bayonetta was a bit too much for me.
That's
on the
a bit of a visual orgy.
But with Infinite Space, it's, you know, with James speaks to it, you're giving him fits of rage and all that, and he says the experienced RPG campaigner, it wasn't something I jumped at immediately, but, you know, I got a copy for pretty cheap. I thought it was worth the risk, something I could continue to work on for quite a while. So at the minute I just have one destroyer class ship, which I've named the Krauthammer after
after Charles?
Yeah, after US political commentator and syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer.
Oh, man.
It's such a badass name. It's awesome.
And he looks it, too. Like, the name, he actually looks like his name. He's one of those guys.
I thought it was an excellent name for the flagship of my fleet.
So, I'm kind of destroyed because I've been naming mine after whales, so I mean,
it's going to be taking a while. But then, as far away from something like Infinite Space as I can imagine, I've been playing over the past couple of weeks here, there, Tiger Woods 12, The Masters. Although I don't wish to overemphasize the Tiger Woods 12 part of that, because the Masters logo is sort of massive and covers most of the box. Tiger's like this little figure in the distance somewhere on Augusta National. But that is, of course, the headline addition to this new Tiger Woods game, is that it finally has Augusta National, which is, I think, has only appeared previously in Japan-only golf games. For whatever reason, they were willing to license it out to obscure, like, I think there was one on the N64 that was the only course in the game, and I think also on the Super Famicom. But this is the first time that we've got, you know, an EA game, either pre or post Tiger, with Augusta National in it. Which it's obviously, if you follow golf at all, it's very important.
It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. It's the course. It's the only course that has a major played at it every year.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're poor or a woman or black, this is probably the only way you'll ever get to play the Masters.
Well, there is somebody who's played and won it four times that fits one of those criteria.
You know what I mean. It's a very controversial country club. Let's put it that way.
So it's dope, but it's great to actually play. And you know, you're familiar with like some of the more famous holes from, you know, incidents that have occurred in the past tournaments, and the greens are really difficult. You really get a feel for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find putting in these Tiger games on Wii quite difficult in general, but it's, you know, when you go on a course that actually has really tough greens, it's a whole other thing. I mean, other than that though, in terms of what, because I had Tiger 10, which was the first Motion Plus Tiger game. And it was like, well, the first Motion Plus game, basically, wasn't it? Because yeah. Wii Sports Resort got delayed and that actually came out first. So I had that and I was very happy with it. But this one, and I think actually, you know, the last year's one, which downplayed Tiger Woods by setting him alongside the wholesome choke artist Rory McIlroy in honor of the Ryder Cup. This one has what they call Advanced Plus motion controls, which you can definitely notice the difference from Tiger 10 anyway, because now not only does it kind of factor in that kind of, you know, the draw and fade, the kind of bend that gets applied to your shots depending on how you swing through them, but also the angle at which you hit them. So you might be aiming at this particular spot, but if you swing in such a certain way, you won't necessarily draw and fade it, you'll just hit it on a straight diagonal.
Yeah. You'll toe it, or, you know, you close the club head and you bring it in, so it'll go to the left, or it'll open and hit to the right.
It gives you feedback on, you know, how open and closed your swing is, inside out, like, and you sort of stat tracks, that kind of stuff. And so it's a lot of feedback you can get to try and sort of improve your swing.
So Greg, when you're in the sand trap, do you have to open up your stance and like open up the club face and stuff?
Now there is another setting, the Tour Pro setting, apparently, which I think is significantly sort of goes beyond even this, to a point where apparently if you swing poorly enough, you don't actually hit the ball at all.
Nice. That's how I golf.
Yeah.
I have definitely missed the ball, which is embarrassing as hell.
It would be realistic, certainly, if I tried that and missed the ball, but I haven't tried. I'm kind of working my way up from where I was on the last Tiger game. Yeah, so at this point, it's like a more nuanced version of what they had that was already very good. It feels natural. It feels, you know, like responsive, but at the same time, it's not too demanding, because I am a terrible golfer. I don't really need to live that fantasy out in video game form.
Well, that always is the danger when you're doing these kind of games where it's sort of trying to be almost simulation.
Yeah, I mean, it is a danger, but on the other hand, I mean, I remember I had one of the Tiger games for GameCube. And that was, you know, pretty well received critically and everything, but I didn't get on with it at all because it had that method where you just sort of flick the analog stick back and forth.
That. Yeah.
And I hated it. And more than that, it seemed to be almost impossible to just miss a drive. You know, I mean, just not a shot that demands a lot of precision, but you just felt like you were never going to mess that up, a sort of routine shot. Whereas here, you know, you could swing well for, you know, 9 holes and all of a sudden just shank it out of nowhere. You know, it's got that kind of natural feel to it, which keeps that sort of element of risk and pressure that's a big part of golf in there. And that's why I like this a hell of a lot more. But I mean, the other thing they've added is a caddy kind of thing where they advise you on what shot to play.
Is it Will Smith?
Yeah, bag of ants joke there. Very nice. So you just press the minus button and it'll basically advise you what kind of shot to play. Because I guess the thing is like, for me, I've played a lot of golf games over the years. You know, I think NES Golf, the original, and PGA Tour on the Mega Drive, and the Mario Golf games on N64 and GameCube. And the thing with those is that at a point, you get the timing down. And just hitting the ball is not really ever a big problem anymore. So it's all about judgment. That's like the entire key to your success is the wind, the elevation, all these different things. Mm-hmm. But with this, I could imagine that you might like to play at such a level with the precision of the motion controls that those parts of the game, just hitting the ball is tough enough that you might actually think, well, you know, I'll let the caddy do the thinking for me on the judgment and let's, you know, speed the gameplay up a bit. So it's not something that I've done because for me, like, judgment is a big part of a golf game, but it's a cool little addition they've made that'll probably, you know, just let people kind of play at whatever level they want to play at the various different facets of the game. All things considered, it's just, I mean, it was already very good. They've improved the presentation somewhat. The graphics look a bit better. And they've got Jim Nantz doing the commentary, who's certainly better and comforting for me because it reminds me of the NFL. But there was one really big advantage that I have now that I didn't have before, which is that I don't think I grumbled about this before. I was certainly entitled to. When I had the Tiger 10 game, you put it in and it's 50 hertz only. It's not progressive scale. And it's not it's a bad PAL conversion type of deal. It's got borders and, you know, it's got the lower refresh rate. And so that was perplexing to me, you know, because I've got other EA games like Boom Blocks and stuff. They don't suffer from this problem. What would be the issue there? So it's a golf game. It's not a big deal. You know, it's not like a fighting game or something where it really nerfed the whole thing. So I just kind of tolerated it. But what I found out since is that because I've got the ability now to boot up American games, to play Excitebots and all that kind of stuff, if you boot up this PAL disc as if it were an American game, it basically is an American game.
It even
comes up with a little disclaimer about online content not being rated by the ESRB, which of course doesn't exist in Europe.
So it's a multi-region Wii game.
That explains why it is. I assume the whole PAL version, it's basically they have the same disc for both regions, and if you put it in a PAL Wii, it boots up in European mode, and if you put it in an American Wii, it boots up in NTSC mode or whatever.
But then that begs the question, why not offer the option in a menu somewhere to play essentially the NTSC American version on your PAL Wii if you have a compatible television with 60 hertz and everything.
Which almost all televisions have been for quite a while.
Right.
You know? don't forget I had a Super Famicom, you know, with some TV 20 years ago that could take NTSC over here.
Sure.
So yeah, no, I agree completely. I think it's outrageous that...
Like you practically have to hack into this to even use this feature, and it sounds like if they're already putting both versions on the disc, let you flip it in the menu, and then all of their European customers can enjoy the good version of the game that they already own.
It's crazy, isn't it? It was really kind of shocking to find out, but I don't know whether it's just something to do with like a few little things, because I haven't been through like the career modes and the online modes and all this kind of stuff that maybe that's where the regional difference matters more, and that's why they kind of lock you out of it, but they still only wanted to have like a common disc for both regions. I'm at a loss to explain it, but anyway, it looks much nicer and plays much more smoothly in 60 hertz. So even though I could easily have done that with the previous version of the game, I'm only really getting to exploit that now. So that's another cool thing. There, before I wrap up, I just wanted to talk quickly about a DS game. So there were these student-made games that Nintendo is distributing through its the Japanese Nintendo channel and those download kiosks that they have over there and things. I think they held a seminar where basically, you know, the aspiring game developers like came in and they could, you know, take some time and have wisdom imparted from Nintendo's people about how to make games or whatever. And then the sort of fruits of those sessions, games for the DS, are now being distributed through these avenues in Japan. And I was able to get the second one. I missed out on the first one because the news kind of broke about this, and then the first one's download window had already expired, unfortunately, but we have impressions of it, Planetaria, I think it's called, on the website. But the second one is called the Tentai Show, for some reason.
Sounds dirty.
Yeah.
So you have a planet in them. It's a dual screen game, you know, in that, you know, it's not a trivial part of it. It's a huge part. The dual display is a big part of it. You've got the planet in the middle and essentially gets assailed by asteroids all around it. But what you have to do is you have like the control over like a black hole, which will suck in the asteroids. But then there's like a line between the black hole, you know, bisecting the planet. And then on the other hand, you've kind of got like a warp gate, the other end of the black hole where these asteroids will come out. So what you're trying to do is absorb all these asteroids coming in on the lower screen typically, and then sort of shoot the asteroids back out on the top screen to deflect even more asteroids coming. You can also actually sort of do this touchscreen gesture where you flick it and then it'll actually swap ends so the black hole will go to the top screen and the thing will go to the bottom screen. But that doesn't really get to be a big part of the gameplay until like some of the later levels. So it's basically a score attack game.
But with a theme of planetary defense.
Yes, that's right. And like, it's basically a score attack game where you get the big points for generating combos. So like, if you absorb like, I think you could absorb a maximum of something like 5 asteroids to make 1 giant asteroid on the other side of the black hole. And then if you fire that off and it takes out 6 incoming asteroids, those points will multiply and get you far more than if you were to just destroy those individually. So that's really sort of the more advanced way to play the game. You get graded according to your score, like, you know, S rank, of course, being the best. And, you know, this is completely free game. You download it from the Nintendo channel and it's got a surprising amount of content. You know, you've got like 3 tutorial stages. You've then got like 3 full stages, each divided into 3 levels. And then when you beat that, you get a credit sequence and then a sort of post game extra hard set of levels as well. So, you know, it's quite impressive what you've got here. I mean, it's certainly, I would think, I've not played DSiWare games, obviously, but I would think it stands up pretty favourably with a lot of DSi games as a value proposition. And it's just a very cool, you know, even after all these years and all these games, it still stands out to me as a very cool kind of use of the dual screen concept, you know, because you're kind of working with the limitation of the fact that you can only sort of touch the one of the two screens. So that's where, you know, the whole thing of occasionally having to flick between, you know, which side the black hole's on and things comes in. And once it kind of ramps up the complexity, you know, at first, it kind of like telegraphs where the asteroids are going to come from. And you're like, oh, that's not necessary. They're coming in so slowly, you know, who cares? But later on, like, you will need that warning because it comes in so much faster. And they introduce other elements like these friendly UFOs that come in. You actually want to allow them to reach the planet because you get points for them and things like that. So you're juggling 2 things at once a lot. It's very cool. I'm really pleased with that. I'll make sure to download the next one. I'm just kind of sad that I'll probably never get a chance to play the first one either, because that sounded pretty nice as well.
It just, the way they're distributing these student games is really strange. I mean, first of all, they're DS games. So it's weird that Nintendo in Japan is doing this promotion after the 3DS launch to release these DS. I mean, this would have been nice a year ago, maybe, you know, when the DS was struggling.
They have actually done it before, I believe. I think they did this maybe back in 2007. This is something they've done before, because that was long before I had a Japanese Wii and access to the Japanese Nintendo channel to enjoy the fruits of that. But I assume the seminar and when the students actually started making these games was months ago.
Sure.
But you're right, the end product timing of it hasn't worked out exquisitely well.
It's just odd. I mean, and I'm sure you can download these on your 3DS.
Yeah, you can do DS download play on your 3DS.
Okay. But still, it's a little strange. But then more than that, I think it's that they're using this, quite frankly, antiquated distribution method of these wireless temporary downloads. So I mean, you can't keep it on your system once you turn it off or try to play another game. That thing's gone. You'd have to re-download it. You can't save your progress or anything. And then they're only hosting one at a time. So once that's gone, you can't get it back.
Yeah, I know. I think that's really ridiculous, though.
They have a shop called DSiWare where they can distribute DS games that are slow.
Well, I mean, I would certainly hope that some of these might make a comeback in some form on, you know, one of the shops, maybe the eShop or whatever.
Couldn't they put them up as like 0 point, you know, free downloads for DSiWare, just like the Flip Show?
Flipnote Studio. Yeah, I mean, well, certainly. But what you've also got to remember, though, is that, you know, the Japanese Nintendo channel has several DS demos on it. You know, they don't just offer one at a time. I mean, and many of these are actually like games from ages ago. I have no idea why, when I go through the list, that the economy training game that they released in Japan is still perfect, like one of the demos at the top of the list. So it doesn't make any sense to me why you have one for a couple of weeks and then that's gone, and then, you know, another one for a couple of weeks. But yeah, the big problem, as I say, is this has actually got quite a lot of content, but you can never switch the system off. I just sort of had it in sleep mode for quite a while, basically, to preserve the game and not have to download it again.
I guess it's some weird way of trying to create hype or excitement over it by saying, oh, limited time only, got to do it now. But I agree. It's just silly.
I think it's great that they're offering these student games to consumers, you know, and sure. I wish I had a way to access it. And I understand that part of it. It is Japanese, but what I don't understand is if they have one way to provide this game to their fans that's temporary and another that could be permanent, and they're both essentially cost the same bandwidth, they run on the same hardware. why would you choose the one that's only temporary? That's
because
what I don't.
It's done by Nintendo. That's why.
I don't have a DSi, so I wouldn't be able to access it or on the DSi shop.
Well, you have a 3DS, which ideally that would.
Well, one day.
Eventually. That will allow
a few
you
more
to do
weeks,
that.
So we won't be able to make that gag anymore.
No, it'll still be funny that it took this long. But
if it's a preview, I think it's great. If there was some promise that we're going to sell these games to you for $2 each in a month, you know, on the eShop or whatever.
Yeah,
DSiWare,
I mean, again, I think, I mean, the fact that they did this before, I mean, I'm thinking if it was in 2007, as I recall, they didn't even have the Nintendo channel back then.
No.
I mean, this would have been strictly from the kiosks that you have in Japanese stores. So, I mean, I suppose it's a step up from that. I mean, maybe that's the problem. It's just they sort of, you know, they're repeating the program again. And, you know, they haven't kind of moved the goalposts sufficiently. But it's curious. But again, this is all the sort of thing that they're going to have to get a lot better at with the eShop.
Mm-hmm. Well, James, tell me about Outland.
So I only played the trial, which is the first stage.
I did too. I want to play more of it though.
I'm not quite as sold as you apparently are on it. I found the trial to be kind of slow. Basically, it's a platformer, 2D.
Yeah, this is on 360 now, but it will be on PSN once that returns.
Oh god, I should realize, I would have liked to be talking about Hardcore Uprising. Actually, I quite wanted to purchase that, but that
if you
wasn't
had a game scheduled to release on the PSN in like the last 10 days, are you just beside yourself? I mean,
oh, and they had Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light on sale, and there was a point where I could have got it cheap, but I didn't, and then you know.
Unpaid for exclusivity by Microsoft. Yes.
Oh, I can one-up you there. When I bought Portal 2 from Amazon, I got a $20 credit, which they do. It's not unusual for them to do. Right. They'll give you some kind of bonus credit for ordering a particular game. And Portal 2 came out towards the end of April. I want to say like mid-April. It was like April 20-something. Yeah. And the credit apparently expired April 30th. I didn't realize it was such a short window. So I was literally on Amazon at 1 a.m, May 1st, thinking, I'm just going to go ahead and order Clash of Heroes for DS. I'm just going to get the DS version. It's like $17. I got this $20 credit. It's free. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to push the trigger. And I go there and my credit's gone.
Yeah.
And it expired literally 15 minutes before that.
Oh.
And I got no warning, anything. It just wasn't there anymore. I'm so pissed. I mean, that was a free game that now I don't know when I'm going to get it.
That's tough.
Which is why I purchased Steel Diver for $5 after my $30 discounts. But it isn't even worth that, guys. Sorry.
Right, so Outland. So it's success. It's a 2D platformer. You jump and hit things with a sword. You can change the color of your character, like Johnny alluded to last week as an Ikaruga mechanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Silhouette Mirage, which I've spoken about before, had that before Ikaruga.
Right.
And it's a platformer that by treasure, the way you switch between blue and red.
Right. And of course, because this is anything in media, the colors are orange and red. I mean, orange and blue, because those colors run everything.
Portal colors, actually.
So I got this game because, as we discussed last week, nothing to do with what Johnny said, because I totally forgot what he said about this game.
No, you never listen to anything anyone says.
But because of what Microsoft's secondary function of the Xbox interface...
Ads.
Exactly.
Ads.
It is to advertise things, and there were at least two separate ads for this game. And seeing as I was just dicking around trying to kill time, I'm like, you know, whatever. I'll download the demo. And that's how I ended up with this game. And then I realized, oh, this is that game Johnny was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So the demo is probably, what would you say, 20 minutes long, Johnny?
Yeah.
You only get to use the color change mechanic for like the last 5 or so minutes of it.
Yeah, it starts out it's a little too hand-holdy and slow.
Yeah,
there is a
point where it teaches you to jump, which is a bit excessive. I don't know. It feels a little bit like a fluidity mechanic where you have to collect stuff that's scattered around the levels with the hope of doing something that the game didn't quite tell you what it was.
You're not selling this for me. I'm sorry.
Well, from what I've heard, James, I think you might actually have a point there, because I was listening to, was it Weekend Confirmed, maybe, where someone was describing this as being very sort of Metroidvania, which you don't get at all from the trial. But
right.
That person has played it a lot more than I have, and so I'll take their word on it, and that makes me want it a lot more. It probably makes you want it a lot less. So,
yeah.
I was really impressed with Outland. I think the presentation of it is
crazy. Yeah, I mean, it's really attractive.
Good.
Yeah, it's got this rotoscope thing going on. It's a very stylized game.
Also a little bit like Ghost Trick.
Yeah, except everything's silhouetted.
It's like Ghost Trick crossed with Limbo or...
Or the Donkey Kong Country Returns levels
like
that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's silhouetted like the Donkey Kong levels, but more colorful. There's more glowy stuff. But it's essentially the same idea.
Right. And where I came up with the fluidity stuff is a lot of it's collecting these items that are basically scattered, and you have to either gain powers to gain access to them or figure out what you have to do to get to them.
Oh, the things you're talking about are, I'm pretty sure those are optional.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're for in the grand scheme of the game. In fact, the game doesn't tell you. The demo basically says, collect them and you'll find out.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks, game. Awesome. Besides that, it seems to be a straightforward A to B kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Combat was a little bit, maybe it gets better, but it felt kind of slow. Like it was just hit things with the sword kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there was some really interesting platforming challenges in there that I assume we'll get more in depth as the game goes on.
Yeah.
To me, that was the most interesting part, was the platforming. But the combat didn't seem all that interesting. And
I kind of doubt that combat is a really big part of the game. But
no, but you do it a lot in the demo.
Yeah.
You have to kill a lot of...
It's also just trying to teach you the mechanics and everything.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kill a lot of that same enemy a bunch of times. But I don't know, the demo didn't quite sell me on the game. Maybe when it goes on sale, I'd be more up for it.
But it's only $10.
Yeah, I know.
It's not that that's an incredible deal or anything,
no.
But a lot of new games on these platforms are launching at $15, so it's nice to see one that actually seems desirable that's $10. It's like, oh, that's a pleasant surprise.
I've become used to the cycle of XBLA games going on sale at some point.
They will. Yeah.
Unlike Nintendo-ware games, which never go on sale ever.
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
Well, might be changing. They've found the light of discounted games.
Fireplace is now 100 Wii points off. Yes!
That's the breaking point for James. That's when he caves in.
Screw it. I'll be soothed for 100 points. You've sold me.
It seems like an interesting experiment of a game. It's obviously, like I said, it's very pretty. The mechanics for platforming were really smooth. I just don't know if it's a game for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was playing Outland, I was downloading other XBLA games because Microsoft servers can actually do both at one time.
Yes.
And you have the console. I would like the option. I really would at this point.
Well, Greg, hold that thought for a minute.
I got something
to talk about that will really turn you green.
I downloaded the two DLC packs for my favorite XBLA game, Toy Soldiers, which, the fact that's my favorite game on the service.
I think we've already established that, James.
Yeah, it's just some sort of terrible coincidence, because the last time that we had to, one of the last times I can remember having TYP, you talked about Toy Soldiers.
Yeah. I mean, the fact I hate tower defense games and I love this game is kind of amazing.
I think you actually might like Toy Soldiers more than anyone else.
It's a really good game. But one of the two DLC packs is basically the Kaiser Offensive, which is a late 1918 offensive. It's basically they just throw big swarms of enemies at you more than at any point in the main game. That's okay. I played that one first. It was interesting. I mean, it was fun to have huge just swarms of enemies coming. But the second demo kind of plays up the toy angle, which is they basically said wind-up toys from the kid who owns this toy set's other toy kits ended up in there. So you get these things like wind-up UFOs, these wind-up Spitfire airplanes, knights on horseback coming around, and the entire game completely changes dynamic because there are these, like, the UFOs just hovering over your base, blasting things from the sky.
So these are essentially new units in the strategy game.
Right. And
oh, that's cool.
There's, like, space tanks that shoot lasers all the way across the level.
And you're trying to fight them with your
World War One era.
One step up from a musket, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. So you're trying to nail them with big trench cannons from across the map. It makes the game more dynamic because it just moves a lot faster. I mean, ultimately, Toy Soldiers is a relatively slow game because it's a relatively slow war.
It's about trench warfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the best depiction of trench warfare in a game.
Until trenched.
And what you end up with now is you end up with what is essentially chaos on a massive scale over trench warfare. I found that demo to be absolute, or that expansion to be absolutely enthralling. Huh. If only because it forces you to rethink some elements of the game, which is nice because ultimately you can develop a strategy that lets you win most battles, and suddenly that strategy sucks and you lose.
That's typical for tower defense, actually. Like, at first you struggle, like, wait, how am I supposed to do this? And then for every game, there's usually this kind of magic alchemy of units and upgrades that will kill pretty much anything they can throw at you.
There's a certain amount of you have to make decisions on which way to go, but ultimately you kind of understand how these binary decisions work. And you're like, okay, well, they're going to do a lot of air power, so less cannons, more anti-air. This time it's just all screwed. And you're like, well, damn. And you have to take a lot more direct control to not lose, which is a nice challenge. But yeah, they're both a lot harder, which is my personal opinion how DLC expansion should work. They should be, you know, more difficult stuff for people who beat the first game and really enjoyed it. And I actually think they're really good value for, I think they were 200 points, and they basically add a whole half of the core game. So by buying them, I've essentially doubled the length of the game, which I'm okay with.
So are you going to talk about Ghost Recon next week?
Yeah, I haven't played any of it yet. Weirdly enough, though, I have been playing Infinite Space, which is kind of odd since Greg brought it up.
Some sort of synergy there.
Because I needed a break from the crippling difficulty of Phantom Brave, so I went to Infinite Space.
The game that you described elsewhere as Rage in a Box. That you are using a game you've described as Rage in a Box as a vacation from another game.
From another game.
This is James.
It's all relative for James, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, I turned a corner on Infinite Space, though, and it got easier. I have not turned that corner on Phantom Brave because I'm not sure there's a corner to turn. So that's... It's just suffer. Eventually, you'll be strong enough to not suffer as much. So, that's where I'm at.
Okay, well, good luck with that. So I've been playing Conduit 2. Actually, I beat Conduit 2 yesterday. I just rented it after my sort of reaction to the first one, which I bought and then subsequently returned for Metroid Prime Trilogy.
I think you made the right choice, Johnny.
Yeah. I was really excited for Conduit, the first one before it came out, and I played it and I liked it, but I didn't like it that much.
John just hated to play online with John and I.
Were there any particular reviews you think might have led you astray in purchasing the original?
It was more the previews and the interviews that I think had me all hyped up, and so anyway, yeah, Conduit 2 I was much more skeptical about, and I have to say, I think the game is a very nice, significant upgrade over the first game. You can tell that they learned a lot. I'd say if the first Conduit felt kind of like a late 90s first-person shooter in terms of the design, you know, I mean, this was something we talked about. It's a lot of corridors and, like, brutally simple enemy AI and just kind of, like, flashy-looking guns that do very simple things.
Perfect Darkian.
Very much so. I would say Conduit 2 feels a little more modern than that.
It feels 2003.
Well, for instance, I'd say that, and I mainly played the campaign, and I don't think it feels as sophisticated as the GoldenEye campaign from last year. I think GoldenEye is a better game, really in every way, than the Conduit 2. It's not as flash, it's not as colorful, but I think it's just better designed. It's more rock solid. GoldenEye is a game that I bought and I'm keeping. You know, I beat it, I've played a lot of multiplayer, I will go back to it at some point and play more of it, I'll bring friends over and we'll do split screen, because GoldenEye is a rock-solid game. Conduit 2 is a little shakier, and it's a little more old-fashioned, but certainly much, much closer to our current expectations of what a first-person shooter should be on a console than the first game was. So they learned a lot in a couple of years, that's for sure. But it's just not good enough. And I think part of the problem for Conduit as a franchise, if they're... Let me tell you, the story... I'm not going to spoil the end of the story, which is like David Lynch, Twin Peaks finale levels of batshit crazy.
Oh, good.
But the story ends on a cliffhanger that makes it quite clear they would love to do a third game.
Which
I just don't know if they're going to get to.
We know they're making a 3DS game, so that's probably it.
Oh, they've got the engine running on 3DS.
Conduit 3D. Duh.
Yep.
There you go. You know, I think this kind of game, I think that the game design of it being slightly less than modern might work better on a handheld where your expectations are a little bit different, you know, and where the sheer novelty of playing a game like that on a handheld might overcome some of your trepidation about the way it's designed.
Not for me. I don't want to play any of these games.
Well, okay. Fair enough.
I don't even like GoldenEye, and I know it's a good game. I mean, it's just, we talked about this when I was visiting with Johnny. It's just, the problem with first-person shooters is that I'm not good at them, and I don't want to put in the effort and time to learn the strategy for a first-person shooter at this point. And so I own GoldenEye. I think it's a good game. I played a couple of sessions. I'm like, okay, I've had enough. I now know for sure I don't like first-person shooters.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. You know, and I think if that's your position, then you probably shouldn't definitely not play Conduit 2 because
clearly.
Even I started out on the normal standard difficulty level out of 3. I was in the middle and I played through about half the game and I got to a certain boss that was just wrecking me. I mean, I tried 10 times to beat this
weak
guy. I finally turned it down to
weak.
Ease to low difficulty. Really didn't make that much of a difference. It was just
good.
He was only vulnerable, and I probably could have gone back and maybe tried again on the normal, but I just ended up leaving it on easy, because even after that, the game has sections of it that are surprisingly difficult to survive, even on the lowest difficulty. And it's not necessarily a matter of my skill at shooting or anything. It's just the number of things that they throw at you and the amount of damage that guys do. And I think mobility is a problem in Conduit 2, because your character moves really kind of slowly and doesn't strafe very quickly. Jumping doesn't really seem to get you away. A lot of the most irritating enemies use melee attacks, which means you like jumping around, your normal sort of ammo dodging doesn't really work on them. They run faster than you. They take a ton of hits to kill. They just soak up bullets and grenades and stuff. Mm-hmm. So unless you have like a very specific weapon that they're sort of weak to or that's highly effective on them, then they're very hard to kill before they do damage to you. And it's okay to get hit a couple times because it does the thing where the screen turns red and then it goes away after a few seconds. But if other guys are shooting at you too, then it's very hard to get out of those situations, because if it's just guys shooting at you, you can almost always kill them before they can kill you. You soak up more damage and you have better guns most of the time. But if it's this big hulking dude in an armor suit who's just running at you, it's very hard to deal with those guys. And I never really found a very good way to do it. I felt like every time I got past one of those guys, it was kind of luck. And a lot of times it was just, I tried the same encounter 2 or 3 times and I finally just sort of scraped through it, but I didn't really learn anything. And I just feel like your character doesn't really move fast enough to avoid people who approach you in that way. And that occasionally comes up in multiplayer too, but it's, you know, because the AI is more simple-minded than people and it's more predictable, etc. But, the campaign's really short. I want to say that I beat it in like 5 or 6 hours.
That is really short.
It's, you know, it's not unusually short, but it's short enough that I feel like I should kind of say something. Because it's basically four levels.
That's too short.
It's four levels with like this hub that you go to a couple of times. And the levels all have a couple different sections to them. Like maybe there's an outdoor section and then you go into the temple and then that's the indoor section. And one thing I'll say is that I think the single player, the campaign levels are much better designed than the first game. They're a lot more open spaces. There's a lot more interesting architecture and level designs and layouts. There's more variety in enemies. There's more variety in weapons that you get throughout the campaign. And there's even a couple places where they try to do some gameplay design. And by that I mean they do stuff like, there are these turrets that you can't kill, so we're going to give you the assault rifle that has a stealth mode on it. So go kill these guys and steal their stealth rifle It's like called ACR-20 or something like that. And this thing's really cool. It's like semi-automatic, so you push the trigger and it shoots a bullet, and it's fairly good, as like a semi-automatic machine gun. But then if you hold down the trigger, it goes into stealth mode. And these two functions play off, there's a tension between them, because, it has infinite ammo. So it just has a heat meter. So as you tap the button and shoot it a bunch of times, the heat meter goes up and it fills up all the way, then the gun overheats and it takes a minute for you to kind of reset it and get it back into working condition. So you want to avoid that. If you hold the button down and go into stealth, then it cools down. And if it gets too close to the limit there, then it freezes, and then you have to do the same thing. You kind of knock the ice off of it and wait for it to come back in working condition. So what that means is you can actually play these two off of each other. So if you want to have a long period of stealth, you can shoot the gun a lot to warm it up, and then hold down the button, and you'll be in stealth for twice as long. It's a really, really cool idea. It's not used in the campaign as well as I think they wanted to. And there's another thing, like, you guys all remember the crazy X-ray thing from Perfect Dark. Farsight. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah.
Farsight.
Hated that thing.
The death gun.
So they have this thing called the phase rifle, and it's ostensibly a sniper rifle, but you can't really use it that way, because you're either shooting from the hip, which means it has this huge cursor and it's really inaccurate and you can't ever hit anybody with it unless you're up in their face, or you can zoom in. And if you zoom in for the sniper mode, it looks through walls, and it can shoot through walls ostensibly. In practice, it can only shoot through walls up to like 10 meters away, which is not really sniper range. And also, let's say if you're behind cover and the other guy's out there, when you go into the zoom, because you're essentially looking at a wall, but you're looking through it, the wall's just like green. So all you see is green. And if the other guy's more than like 10 meters away, you can't see him at all. So it's just to see this sea of green. Okay, useless. The only way that it's really useful is if he's hiding behind cover and you have an open range between you and him, which doesn't happen that often. In the campaign mode, at least. And I don't think it would be that useful in multiplayer either, because people move around so fast that you would never really be able to use it. So I found that weapon to be neat in theory. It seemed to be kind of a revised version of the Farsight that is completely useless. So it's like they just went the other way with it. The Conduit 2 is full of all these neat ideas. I mean, they have a bunch of really big, flashy boss battles. And, you know, boss battles are fairly unusual in first-person shooters. And I think Conduit 2 is a very good example of why that is. Because they're annoying.
Ringing endorsement here.
They take forever to kill. They have these giant life bars. The strategy to defeat them is fairly simple to figure out. And, again, your health regenerates. So as long as they don't hit you too much in too short of a time period, you're not going to die. But it just takes forever to get their life bar down, and you're constantly going back to some ammo box and just restocking. It's just annoying. It's not really that much fun. They look cool, but they're not actually. It reminded me of the bosses in Geist, which are the worst thing about Geist, the worst part about Geist. And this is very, very similar to that. So the campaign has moments that I think are pretty cool. The story is hilariously awful. It seems to be intentionally so, which I don't really think is an excuse. I'm not interested in B-movies. I don't find Cobra to be very entertaining. Sorry, I don't. I would never watch that again. So, I mean, the voice acting is horrible. But they literally got the voice of Duke Nukem to play the main character.
Nice.
Which must have seemed like a good idea before they found out Duke Nukem Forever was actually going to... Was actually going to come out after all. But he's just playing Duke Nukem, and the lines he says are not funny. Like, there's a character named Andromeda who's some kind of Atlantean. Like, this ancient civilization, she wears this crazy... She looks like a character from Brutal Legend. Like, she's wearing this ridiculous metallic armor. And she's been in stasis, and you wake her up, And, you know, this person's thousands of years old. She has all this knowledge. She's supposed to help you in your quest. And the first thing that your character says is, wow, you're a stone cold fox. It's not funny. It's not funny. It doesn't make sense. And it's not actually amusing, except that it's so horrible. Like, I find it
horribly funny.
I can't believe they actually wrote that line and
had
him say
it. That's
why it's
funny, though. Like, wow, somebody wrote this shit? Holy crap.
I don't get that stuff. I mean, the sad thing is, it's sort of like what I said about Mega Man Legends 2 last week. The story on paper, the outline of the plot of the story is actually kind of neat. Like, you're globe hopping, you're using these conduit portals to warp all over the world, these different locations, but then the actual writing, like the actual dialogue in the game, the way this stuff is explained to you is horrifying. So, I played a bit of multiplayer too, and that was fun. It felt similar to the experience of playing the first one, except less buggy.
No random you lose.
The levels are kind of larger, and I think they're laid out a little bit better. And the weapons are sort of unlockable, so you have loadouts. So it's kind of like Call of Duty, where you start out with a couple of crappy weapons, and then as you play more, you earn credits, and it's GoldenEye did the same thing. But you know, you eventually unlock the better weapons. And actually, once you do that, you can go back and play with those in the single player, because there's a place in the hub world in the campaign where you can actually change your loadout there too. And it's not explained at all. So it took quite a while before I figured this out, almost by accident. Another thing that's not explained at all is the fact that the game downloads patches when you go in online multiplayer. And I have no problem with that. I mean, I think for a multiplayer shooter, you need to have that. The first game really needed it and couldn't do it. There was a limited amount of stuff on the server side that the developer tweaked after the fact, but there wasn't really anything they could do to the game itself after they launched it. And I think for a multiplayer shooter, you need to have that capability, and that's great. What the game doesn't tell you anything about is that they can also patch the single player through this process, which is a very good thing, because they ship the game with a crippling bug in the very first level that prevents you from completing the first level of the game.
Oh, yeah.
And we thought that the Wii was immune from this stuff just because there was no infrastructure for DLC.
Oh, no, my reviews have told me otherwise.
I guess I'm sheltered.
Here's the thing. I don't care about this stuff in an Xbox game, for instance, because I put the game in on my Xbox, and before it even lets me play the game for the first time, it checks for updates, right, and it downloads anything it finds. So if that game shipped with a game-crippling bug, I'll never know. As long as they fix it before I come to play it, then I'll never know the difference. In The Conduit 2, I'm playing through the first level a week after the game comes out, more than a week, and I get to this point, and it's telling me to go somewhere, and there's just this gate that's locked that I can't get through. And I'm like, I play through this part like three times. Like, did I do something wrong? What the heck is going on here? It makes no sense. And I go to GameFAQs, of all places, and find out that they have patched this, but the only way to get the patch is to go to the online multiplayer mode and download it there, which, you know, when I get a game like this, I always play the campaign first.
Right.
So that I learned the guns, and I learned the levels, and I learned the controls and everything. I wasn't planning to do the online multiplayer until probably I'd already completed the campaign. So this was not something I would have done unless I'd found out on GameFAQs. And so, you know, just a disclaimer for everybody out there, if you end up trying Conduit 2, the very first thing you should do is go to online multiplayer and download the patch, even if you have no intention of playing multiplayer. And if your Wii is not connected to the internet, do not go out and buy or rent Conduit 2 at all.
Because you will not be able to play it.
Wow.
Yeah, they've also fixed, like, aim down sights. They've tweaked that. I mean, I'm glad they're patching. I'm glad they're following up with it, but don't you have someone play this game before you ship it?
That's a pretty big bug. Game not playable.
30 minutes into the game, I am locked in. I cannot proceed. It wouldn't have taken you very long to find this bug.
You can't expect the testers to play for 30 minutes.
No. Don't blame the testers.
I blame Sega. It's Sega's game. Yeah. They published it. They distribute it. It's their responsibility.
That's awful.
I think if you're really interested in online multiplayer on the Wii, this is probably a good purchase for you. It seems to be very full-featured on that front. It supports the headset thing, the headbanger.
The headbanger.
John has, and he's never used. There are a lot of cool guns. There are a number of levels. It supports, I think, 12 players at the same time. It seems to run well. One thing I'll say is that when you're playing online, the levels actually look pretty much like they do in the single-player campaign, which was a huge problem for the first game, where they looked like N64 graphics when you played online, because they just couldn't handle the geometry passing back and forth. So
I remember when the three of us, John, yourself, and I, played this game online, besides the fact that it would randomly tell us we lost and it would end, the other memory I have is we would run around looking for each other for a long-ass time.
Yeah.
And just not, we would basically be following the sound of each other shooting wildly in the wind. Is it still that bad?
I think it's better. I mean, I only played random matches, so there were always at least 6 or 7 people in there, if not more.
But I mean, are they funneling you to a central location?
I think they are. And, okay. And a lot of the modes are going to do that anyway, because I played some where they have control points, and you're going and, you know, sort of capturing certain locations on the map until they turn to your side. Although they never told me which side I was on. So that was kind of frustrating. When you're on a team game, it'd be nice if they told you which fucking team you've
been
assigned to.
Like, if there's a little reminder on your HUD, hey, you're on the blue team.
I don't think there is. I couldn't find
one. Just a heads up, you're on the blue team still.
I was extremely confused. I start shooting a guy and he didn't die, and I'm like, I guess he's on my team and his name is Blue, so I must be on the blue team.
Sorry, bro.
That's pathetic.
Usability testing, guys. Come on.
Seriously. Maybe they'll patch that in later.
Patch in icons.
There's another mode where it's kind of a free-for-all, but they assign you a target. There's one person who you have to kill, and then there's someone else on the map whose job it is to kill you. It may not be the person you're trying to kill. So they're basically, you know, there's a radar, and one person's yellow, so they're forcing you to go and find that one person.
Right.
But the maps, I think, generally are designed such that they're not as sort of arbitrarily open and expansive.
Right.
You know? So I didn't play a ton of online, but I got the feeling that that would be less of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, that was my biggest issue with the online, was that...
Yeah, it was serious for the first game.
Like 5 minutes of us just running around going, where is everybody?
Yeah, I think if there is another Conduit game for 3DS or even for Wii, I would certainly be interested in picking it up and playing it again. But at this point, it's obvious that the developers listen to their fans, they're taking feedback, they're taking it seriously, they're trying to implement it, and I get that. I think the problem for the series is it doesn't really have an identity or its own personality. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very clearly imitating a lot of other franchises like Halo, GoldenEye, etc. Perfect Dark is a big influence on this game. So it's clearly imitating and paying tribute to all of those. But it doesn't really have very many ideas of its own. It doesn't really do something that other games don't do. I mean, when it first came out, when the first game came out, what it did that other games didn't do is that it was a first-person shooter on the Wii that was competent.
It had reflective surfaces on a Wii game. That was what it did.
Yeah, like it did all this graphical shit that you don't care about. So, but for the most part, it was a good first-person shooter on the Wii, and that was its identity. And that's not really a special thing anymore. There's several of those, and there are some that are better. So at this point, I think they really need to figure out, what do we do that other people can't or won't do that sets our game apart? Because I think they want it to be like the premier first-person shooter for the Wii, and they don't have the budget to do that, you know? They really don't. I mean, this game feels really amateurish compared to GoldenEye. And it kind of is, quite frankly. I mean, no disrespect to the developers, but you guys aren't on the same level as Eurocom. And Eurocom's not exactly a AAA company, but they're good, and they have a lot of experience doing this. Eurocom's been making James Bond first-person shooters on Nintendo consoles since N64. So they kind of know what they're doing, and you guys don't, and it shows. And that's the sad truth of it. I mean, Conduit 2 is a good game. I enjoyed playing it, but I'm glad I didn't buy it.
They're not Eurocom, and Sega's not Activision, basically.
No, they're not. Not anymore. So yeah, one other thing I played this week is, and I just, like James, I only played the demo for this, but I did check out Bangayo HD Missile Fury on XBLA. Because I knew you guys would be interested in hearing about it, and maybe some of our audience would be. You know, it's out now. It's $10 too. And it is really exactly like Bangayo Spirits for DS.
Yeah, it sounds like much the same game, like with the creator level stuff. And, you know, I mean, they've just kind of adapted it for twin sticks. I mean, I'm sure the controls feel a lot more natural with twin sticks.
They do, yeah. That threw me off a little bit at first, just because I had gotten used to playing it in this weird...
Missile Fury.
thing on the DS. The DS really has weird controls because there's so many functions that they want you to be able to do. And
yeah, it's kind of a bit overreach, really, because, yeah. I mean, obviously it goes back to the N64, where I think you're using like the analog stick and the C buttons.
Hmm.
And I think it's all about, you know, like omnidirectional attacks and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, just a standard DS interface is really kind of inadequate. But I think they did a really good job of making them functional. They just took to get it used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it controls well. It looks good. It's all 2D sprites, of course, and a lot of them. And
yeah, that's my guy.
But the, you know, the art style certainly hasn't changed. And oddly enough, a lot of the sprites don't really seem to be more detailed than they were on DS. They're just bigger. I mean, you have a much bigger screen, but it's still like, what fruit is that?
But it's HD. It says it in the
title.
It's
kind of yellowish orange, so maybe it's
an orange. Oh, it's a orange. Perfect.
But I'm not really clear on that. And, I mean, of course, it doesn't matter. But the graphics are not nearly as detailed as you might think. And, you know, considering the number of sprites that they're throwing out there, I think actually having too much detail could actually make it even harder to tell what's going on. Sure. So it might be a very deliberate choice, but I was just kind of surprised by that. But, you know, if you've played Bangaio on Dreamcast or N64, I can't speak to that. I've never played those versions. I got the sense that Spirits was a bit of a departure and that it's more of an a la carte. Here's 300 levels, play them in any order, we don't care.
Yeah, and also there's no real bosses in Spirits.
That's true.
You get big enemies, like, so they have a few stock, like, major enemies, but there's none of the kind of really crafted boss encounters that you associate with Treasure. You know, even if they do games in different genres, you expect that. So that's where I'm not sure how big a part they are of the original Bad Gaia versions, but I'm pretty sure they're in there as opposed to just not in Spirits.
Yeah. Yeah, and in Missile Fury, it really seems like kind of, let's do Spirits again, but sell it to a different market and try to improve it a little bit, you know.
Well, because the thing is, of course, in Japan, you know, 360 is like the shooter console. I mean, it's got this whole, like, little sector of the industry that just, you know, obviously the download space is a big part of that, so I guess it makes sense as another venue, considering I can't imagine. I'd certainly, all the indications were it did pretty badly on DS, unsurprisingly.
Sure. You know, Bangaio's not a shooter. It's not a shoot 'em up in the sense of like a Gradius or an R-Type.
No,
it's a very different kind of game. It's really not like anything else. I mean, it's a unique franchise, I think. And just from playing the demo, from the very beginning, the demo's only like 3 stages. It's really short. And
yeah, that would be
it
true.
Really introduces you immediately to the idea that this game is about filling the screen with a bajillion missiles, and it's in the name too. But
Missile Fury,
it's just so outlandish. It's so over the top from the very beginning. It gives you almost no instruction about how to actually play the game when you start the game. And there is a tutorial, but it's easy to miss. And I really think the Western audience is probably going to ignore this the same way that they ignored Trouble Witch's Neo, which was last week's XBLA shooter of the week. you know, even though this is a Treasure game, I don't think that matters to the average American or even average European. So I think this probably will do well in Japan. I think America probably still doesn't care. And because it is basically the DS game, just bigger, I don't really think they're going to find a huge new market for Bangaio now that it's on 360.
I do think I have heard there is a significant difference in the sense that, if you recall, with the DS game, you could choose from a set of weapons before you went into the stage. So it kind of gave you, you know, the option to employ a bunch of different kind of approaches to a different stage. Maybe you'd experiment a little bit with some different weapon combinations, see what works. Now, in this one, you don't have that choice anymore.
Right,
so I don't know whether that implies a completely different level design paradigm where it's very much more specific.
Doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, so I would be quite interested if that were the case, how different it would feel. But at the same time, maybe it's just, you know, made it simpler for them.
It does give you different loadouts for each level.
Yeah, for each level, but you can't just pick whichever one
you
like.
Right, you can't customize it. And I wonder if maybe that's like an option you unlock from beating the game or something.
I didn't sound like that from the interview I read about it.
It's weird. You know, I found that the level of customization in the loadout in the DS game was actually kind of a hindrance sometimes, because I'd get used to a certain combination, I'd get to feel like I actually knew how to use it, and I'd understand the tempo of using the EX moves and things like that, and then I'd come to a stage where that combination that I had gotten used to was completely ineffective, and I had and for some people that's very appealing, that it makes you go back and learn how to use a different configuration. For me, a lot of times though, I felt like I really didn't have a clear sense of why is this not working, what weapon would be better, and so a lot of times I just sort of randomly remixed it until I found a new combination that actually did work for that level. And then I'd use that one for a while until I got to the next level that just didn't work at all. And I just rinse and repeat for 300 levels. So, it's almost appealing to me that they just kind of give you whatever is the ideal loadout for that level. But ultimately, I decided that I'm probably not going to buy Missile Fury because it feels so much like the DS game. And I spent plenty of time playing the DS game, like 2 or 3 weeks where that's all I did. And I just feel like I've had enough of it. It just doesn't seem like a notably new version of the game, and I don't know that I even needed more Bangaio anyway. But I think it's nice that it's on a new platform, it's out there for a new market now, and it does have better controls. So there's a lot to be said for it. It's just for me personally, because I was one of the few people who did buy Bangaio Spirits. I think I've had enough Bangaio for a while.
So you're telling me you don't have Fury then?
No, I
he won't have it either. Okay. I did hear today that Guardian Heroes is going to be making an appearance on XBLA. So. Yeah,
that artwork they showed looks horrible.
It looks awful.
What the hell was that?
That would be the Sega Saturn look.
But Guardian Heroes is like a brawler, right? It's like a double
dragon. It's a brawler with RPG elements.
See, that's like Castle Crashers. It doesn't really appeal to me very much. But
Not desperately to me either. But it's interesting they seem to be working through a lot of their sort of back catalogue now, obviously with Ikaruga they released on XBLA. James talked about that last week. Silver Gun's on its way.
Yeah, that I'm excited for.
Yeah, I know.
Are they porting Silver Gun code, like one line of code a week?
I mean, think they're literally making a new game that is called Radiant Silver Gun.
Because they're not, you can't really port it from that. Nah. But I mean, don't forget, Treasure's a very small company. So if they're working on new stuff, for whatever the hell they're working, maybe it's an original downloadable game, maybe it's for 3DS or God knows what they're actually doing. But if they're doing that, then they don't have a lot of bandwidth to do retro stuff on the side. So that's probably why Guardian Heroes looks the way it does.
We need Stretch Panic on 3DS with using the augmented reality.
No!
No!
No! I think James knows something about Stretch Panic.
I know I don't want to see that in 3D.
That's his reaction. It's about reaching out and pinching things.
Pinching women's breasts until they pop. Yes. That's what the game is about.
Sounds like Duckman.
I think this will be very popular in Japan. So, Mike.
Yes.
Bring it home, please.
Well, I got a couple of things I want to talk about. And the first thing I've been playing, and mostly playing this, is Radiant Historia, which you guys have already talked about quite a bit.
So, lovingly caressed.
Underexposed
game here on this.
Well, to be fair,
podcast.
We're the only podcast talking about it, I think.
It's true.
So.
Well, so a couple of observations. I've played about 12 or 13 hours so far. I don't know how far I'm in the game. I
just crossed the 60-hour mark.
What?
I'm in the epilogue that will never end, it feels like.
How are you in the 60?
I feel like,
jeez,
I'm just now getting to the point where maybe time travel becomes a bigger deal. Because I've had one or two spots where I've had to go back and whatever, I brought something back in time or to the alternate timeline and been able to progress. But I feel like I've gone through quite a bit of the alternate history, and I've left the primary history mostly untouched or whatever. I'm at the start of the second chapter as opposed to done with like a third chapter and the alternate. So I'm not sure I've gotten the full flavor for the game yet, but one thing I did want to talk about is the battle system a little, because I think it's a really interesting battle system that maybe you talk about too much. It almost reminds me of playing Fire Emblem, if that makes any sense, because there's kind of a, once you get to the more complicated battles, and this is sort of just what I started discovering the last couple of times I played. You, especially if you've like switched your characters, so you have like 8 character attacks, like 8 moves in a row. Mm-hmm. You wind up kind of organizing and doing these intricate, push this guy to the side, then, yep. then attack, then push him here. Like I had a battle, I was forced to use the little girl, Ankh, or whatever her name is.
Ot.
And one of her moves that's more powerful is putting these mines down on the ground.
Yeah, and, the bombs. Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I was forced to play with her and this other character I didn't really like for a while, and I didn't really get it until, like, at the boss battle. I'm like, oh my god, I can do this. So I was like shoving this, planting a bomb, and then shoving the baddie, the boss, onto the bomb, and then I would shove him someplace else and hit another bomb, and then another place and hit another bomb. And it was just sort of this intricate thing where I had to go back and forth a few times just to figure out what the heck I was going to do to craft this complex attack. And it's very much like something like Fire Emblem, where you want to figure out, well, what order I need to move these characters so that no one's in the way of anyone else, and that, you know, I want to kill this guy first because he's really weak. And so, I don't know, it's surprisingly complex and surprisingly robust battle system that I think, to me, is almost more interesting than the time travel type stuff.
It's like setting up now I'm blanking on the name of those really convoluted machines that do simple things.
Rube Goldberg.
Rube Goldberg.
Yeah, it's almost like setting up a Goldberg machine for your battle strategy.
Yeah, it kind of is, but only when you're doing these more complex, longer-chain things.
So I touched on the review a bit more than we did on the podcast, how shifting the strategy around the battle becomes important later on. There are a few bosses where I don't know how you beat them without using Ott and the bombs. Hmm. I mean, I physically don't see how it's possible. Once Ott became a permanent party member, she never left because she is so powerful.
See, I use her very little.
She becomes an unchecked force of nature at some point. And what's interesting is if I can only get one bomb down, I'll use her attacks because there's the combo meter, and as the combo meter builds up, the attacks become more powerful.
Oh, is that how it works? I didn't realize.
So you can do a lot of weak attacks to build up the combo meter and then finish off with your most powerful spell.
Right.
One thing I do a lot is I'll use an air assault with stock, your main character, which knocks a character up into the air. And then while the enemy's up in the air, suspended up there, I'll have Rainy, who's kind of my magic user. She'll use her most powerful black magic spell on the boss. So then it'll do a lot of damage because the combo meter is already up to a certain level, and then the boss falls down and takes more damage from the impact at the bottom.
Right.
So that's like a 2-character combo that I don't have to set up. I don't have to move the character around a lot to do it.
So Ott, she does 4 hits for her attack. She does that jing, 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 jing. And none of them do a lot of damage, but it quickly bumps up your meter a bunch of times.
I see.
So I had a boss where I had to bump up the meter to like 30 for him to take any damage. So I had the whole screen filled. I had all of her turns except for one at the very start. So everybody else did more damage that way. And then the very last attack was somebody knocking a bomb she set on the very first turn over. And it wiped him out in one hit because I had built up that combo meter. So the combo meter was at like 65 and they hit him over and bang.
But, I'm not really seeing the strong relation with Chrono Trigger right now. I don't think it really reminds me of Chrono Trigger very much. It does remind me kind of Majora's Mask, the whole replaying the same stuff again, the kind of the deja vu. So I do like that. The other game I wanted to talk about is Mega Man X. And I think I've established, if not on this podcast, on Radio Trivia, which you should listen to, by the way, that I'm not a big Mega Man fan. I played Mega Man, I think 6 on the NES and really enjoyed that, but then really couldn't get into any of the other games. And I would get to a certain point usually and then just sort of grow frustrated with the game. I actually mostly enjoyed Mega Man X. I was giving it another shot and I was pleasantly surprised. There were a few places where I got frustrated. There are definitely some cynical parts in the game. The mini boss were in the water level where there are spikes that you can die instantly on. I mean, that's the kind of shit that I hate about Mega Man. And there were one or two bosses where it's like, I just couldn't figure out the pattern right away. And so I died and had to play through the entire level again. And that to me, I don't like that. I don't like having to replay through the whole level.
It's worse in X than it is in some of the later X games, but in X, it's really bad.
And then of course there's like a couple of areas where they just throw a crap load of enemies at you. And the only thing I could think to do is use that charged up chameleon. where you're invincible. Like there's one vertical section in one of the castle levels that it slowed down. I'm like, what the hell am I supposed to do here? And then you fall down and they're all back there because you kill them. But
oh, right. So, you've gone off one millimeter.
Yeah.
I think I actually know the exact place you're talking about. It's because you're trying to climb these ladders.
Yes.
And sort of wall jump up this long vertical shaft.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good place to go invisible.
So I didn't actually beat the game. I kind of grew frustrated, as I often do in Mega Man games, at the final boss. I'm like, you know what? I don't need to play this. I'm done. Because I've died a couple times. I'm like, I've seen most of the game now. It's okay.
So have you seen where Sigma whips out his lightsaber yet?
That is
it's awesome. Like, just exactly like Luke's when in Return of the Jedi.
I don't think so. I think I read that on a game fact at some point for a strategy. I'm like, you know what? I don't need to beat this game.
It gets vividly reenacted in the opening video to Mega Man X3 in comedic fashion.
I see. The other thing I wanted to mention briefly, it's kind of going back a little ways, but I was at PAX East as well, as listeners know, and one game I wanted to mention really briefly, because Johnny was there to watch it, was Sonic Jam, which was something I'd always wanted to see. And there's this 3D overworld, which I guess is the first time Sonic was like in real 3D in pseudo-platformer form. And it is, oh my god, it's butt ugly, and it's just crude, the controls do not work. Like, we were just laughing watching this thing. Like, oh my god, this thing exists.
So, maybe you should explain what Sonic Jam is.
Sonic Jam actually is interesting because it's a compilation of the Genesis games. And I don't know if it was emulation or if it was recreation, re-implementation on the Saturn, but it was kind of novel for the time. I'm not sure how many other packages were out like that were a compilation of a series.
Not many at that time.
So it's a Saturn game that has kind of crummy versions of Genesis because of slowdown and or frames being dropped, if not that.
Ugh.
Yes, in a Sonic game. And then you can either access those through a menu or you can do this hub world that's in 3D, and you can walk around and you can turn the camera. So it's not faux 3D. It's actually 3D, but it just looks really crude, and there's really nothing to do. You can kind of explore, but there really is poor. It's really hard to judge depth. Sonic goes really slowly, and it's hard to, like, because you have a digital D-pad. Did they have an analog stick that they eventually introduced?
They did have an analog pad with not. They came out with Longsword Knights, didn't it?
I don't think it was supported by Sonic.
Yeah,
Jam.
I don't think
no,
so
probably
either.
Probably not.
So it's just this really weird thing, and there isn't much to do there. You can just sort of walk from like shop to shop where they have these different things like artwork from the games and the ability to access.
Oh, God.
It's the perfect thing for PAX. You know, it is the sort of thing you would want to check out at PAX, because there's no way in hell you would want to check it out otherwise.
What's funny is we played a bunch of Saturn games collectively, and I think we all just walked away just laughing at how terrible they were.
The interesting thing is that I think that Sonic Jam did come out before Mario 64, so it is an interesting look into attempts at 3D pseudo-platforming before Mario did it right.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of examples like that, though. I mean, Mario 64 was by no means the first 3D platformer. It was just the first good one.
Yeah. Significantly.
I remember I saw you play Sonic Jam, and I thought, you know, in some ways this is really impressive. Like, the little world that you're going around in is really kind of small, but it did remind me of the first level in Mario 64 in some ways.
It reminded me of the castle area in Mario 64 a little bit, actually.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's got multiple levels, you know. It makes good use of the fact that the world is in 3D, so you can kind of go up and you can go around things.
Yeah.
They have moving platforms in and out, which are very hard to jump onto. But at the same time, Sonic looks really poor. I mean, it's just the character model was not translated well to the polygons. They didn't know how to do that. You know, I mean, this is a flat character.
Yeah.
So making him into three dimensions is not obvious how to do that, but he really looks bad.
I guess this was his finest hour on the Saturn. I mean, it's always incredible to me that you had this whole market that was built in large part off Sonic's success with the Genesis in North America especially, and then they did very little to capitalize on that on Saturn. Clearly, I mean, this suggests that there was, you know, they were experimenting in 3D and they probably didn't like the results of their experiments.
No, they didn't.
But, and yet they released them publicly.
Yeah.
Because this is obviously a tech demo.
Yeah.
And yet it's kind of thrown in here with this
because
compilation.
They had to have a Sonic game. I mean, they probably felt like, oh my god, are suddenly, and the system is out. Strategy didn't work out so good.
Yeah. Can we also say that Sonic Jam is one of the worst video game titles of all time?
Oh, no. Not even close.
It came with a really awesome little, like, I don't know if it was a cardboard sticker or what, but Johnny, you saw this too. It was like, be cool, stay in school, or like, winners don't use drugs, or some really 90s.
Oh, boy.
Oh, no, it had to do with fighting. It was like, Sonic says, don't fight, or something like that.
Sonic says, beat the crap out of people.
Didn't he used to do stuff like that in the shitty cartoon from that period?
Sure. I'm sure he
like
did.
Like, knowing is half the battle moments.
Okay, I took a picture of this. I pulled it up. There's a banner at the top. It says, cool kids know it's not right to fight. And then there's Sonic in the middle, and on the left, Tails is saying, keep your wits. And on the right, Knuckles is saying, choose to split.
Oh. Yeah.
And as we all know, cool kids owned Sega Saturns in 1995.
Oh my god, that's unprecedented.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with Extra Life Jurassic Park. Who else but Zach takes us through this genetic reconstruction of his childhood memories of the NES movie license game of Jurassic Park. He seems to really love this top-down action adventure, despite the lack of any save feature or a playable Dickie Attenborough.
Is he a sir? Is he Sir Dickie Attenborough?
I'm pretty sure both he and his brother are knights.
It's a low bar, apparently.
He played Gandhi.
I've seen Gandhi, and I would knight him, too.
It's, what have you got against Gandhi, James?
James hates peaceful disobedience and civil rights.
I want my disobedience to come in the form of rage. Speaking of rage,
Lord of Rage,
we have a review of Rango the video game from formerly known as Andy from Iowa, now known as Andy Gergen, our reviews editor. He got stuck reviewing a predictably mediocre video game on the Wii. Despite great graphics and the authentically voiced cutscenes, he finds the gameplay to be severely lacking.
Rango.
It's a movie about a lizard who plays a sheriff. Go figure.
Hey, the best 3DS games feature is finally wrapped up. By the time you hear this, we'll have posted everything all the way up through number one, so the whole thing's on the site now. If you haven't checked it out or if you haven't looked at it recently, you should go back and see the ones that topped off our list with staff selections. And then, you know, the talkback thread, which is already huge. You know, let us know what your top 10 or top 5 or whatever DS games would be.
Yeah, I think it's a good wrap-up of really awesome stuff that was on the DS.
So, next up we have a feature called 3DS Battery Tests, where Nicholas and James put together a really interesting report with a complete battery of battery tests.
Oh, God.
For that fickle 3DS system.
Well, Nick did all the testing, and this was his idea, so I want to give him most of credit here.
All right. But yeah, Nick did it very scientifically. Basically, it's like, here's the 3DS with everything turned on. Now we're going to turn things off one at a time and compare how that affects the battery life. And so basically, through these charts, the results that you get, you can find out which features like the brightness, the volume, the 3D, the wireless, affect the battery life more than others.
Well, we also have a really cool secret about the GDC trailer for Zelda Skyward Sword. Aaron's blog post details the recent discovery that the music used in the recent Zelda trailer, part of it is actually a reversed version of Zelda's lullaby. You can compare the normal and the reversed clips on the blog post. Or you can check out my little thing that I just can play right now for you. There you go.
Oh. All right. Well, be sure to go check out all this original content and the latest news and Project Cafe rumors at NintendoWorldReport.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Greg has the first letter.
Isaac writes, "Hey guys, let me start by saying thanks for the fantastic show. RFN has quickly become my favourite gaming podcast of them all, so keep up the good work. Now, the DS and PSP are both filled with quality JRPGs in the form of remakes, re-releases, and original titles. This is in fairly stark contrast to the three major consoles, which have had rather underwhelming JRPG offerings this generation. There are definitely a few solid ones, sure, but nothing compared to the PS1 to PS2 era. I think one of the major reasons for this is the increase in development costs that has accompanied the newest generation of consoles, making a 30 to 40 hour JRPG with high quality production values rather infeasible for all but a select few franchises and developers. The DS and PSP were able to avoid this issue due to their relatively low level of image quality and also their high level of popularity in the Japanese market. My question is, do you think this trend will continue with the next generation of handhelds, 3DS and NGP? Do you foresee a large number of great JRPGs on these systems, or do you think that the upgraded visual fidelity will keep developers from continuing with this strategy?"
I think they will. I mean, I think the nature of portable games is that, especially on the DS, there were really fancy-looking games and there were really simple-looking games, and they were able to coexist. And I think that'll continue on 3DS. So I do think you'll see a bunch of JRPGs on the 3DS.
We've already seen that. If you look at the games that have been announced for the 3DS, there's plenty of JRPGs on the list.
They're doing that, the Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor Overclock, that's like a port of an enhanced port of a DS game. You got Tales, a remake of that, you know.
Right. Which already means there's more JRPGs than on the Wii.
I think this has less to do with development costs than it does just people's gaming habits, because, you know, in this generation, the Wii had much lower development costs than the other systems, and I'd say it actually has fewer JRPGs.
But it's also probably the least demographically inclined to play those games, too.
The fact of the matter is the Wii is still far and away the most popular console in Japan.
And it's the cheapest console to develop for, and yet there are almost no JRPGs on it.
Well, I mean, there's four big ones. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, Nintendo has specifically sponsored two.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't wish to dismiss them, because apparently they're quite high quality and they've got good pedigrees behind them and all that. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of like developers making some sort of judgment about what's economic, they didn't make that judgment. Nintendo made that judgment as a platform holder.
And also, those
different
games don't exist for me.
Not yet, anyway. Yeah.
And maybe not at all, but they don't even have a release date. So the fact that Xenoblade is out in Japan a year ago really doesn't do me a whole lot of good. And I like JRPGs.
I mean, I think some of it is, you know, as you said, in terms of habits, you know, portability, you know, lends itself to these kinds of games where you can just, you know, you try to pour time into them wherever you can, here, there. You know, for me, it's completely kind of reinvigorated my interest in the genre, just playing them on a handheld. So, I mean, I just think that is where the market is, because, you know, in Japan, yeah, you want to play it on the train, or the public transport, or whatever, you know, that's the way to do it.
I do think that the cost of development is still a major factor on the HD systems, because you've seen a lot of the games that have come out have been console sponsored. All of Microsoft's JRPGs are console sponsored. A couple of Sony's are console sponsored. I mean, the big outliers are like Final Fantasy X.
You mean 13?
13, yeah, which is multi-platform. And
yeah, you're really stretching it there, James. There are a number of
the big ones. A lot of the big ones are console sponsored.
The big ones, like, you mean Lost Odyssey and Blue Dragon? I mean, you got Tales of Vesperia. You've got the Chopin game that you played. I mean, that's on both systems. There are a number of JRPGs that either are multi-platform or just are on one system or the other, and were not published or sponsored by the console holders. I think there are some, yes, there are some high-profile examples, but then there's also a number of ones that weren't, and some of them were pretty successful.
I wouldn't know if I'd go pretty successful.
I'm a little surprised there aren't more JRPGs on downloadable services. I know there's that Cthulhu game that was inspired by JRPGs that Johnny talked about before.
Yeah, that's an indie game.
And then there's Final Fantasy IV: The After Years,
which was a cell phone game at one point.
Yeah.
Okay. But I can't think of any other examples, and I'm just a little surprised there wasn't more of that.
I think the big divide here, though, really is between portables and consoles rather than how powerful they are. And again, I mean, I think TYP makes a big point where just when you take it down to portables, I think a bigger variance in production values and aesthetics is kind of just, it seems to be accepted a lot more, just judging by, you know, the range of stuff that you have seen on the DS. And, you know, already on 3DS, there's going to be a pretty big range, you know, between games that are ports of DS games like that, Devil Survivor, or, you know, ports of N64 games like Zelda, and then original games. I mean, there is a big variance developing already of what's visually acceptable on 3DS. So I don't think that's going to stop anyone from developing a JRPG for 3DS because they thought, oh, but now we have to make it like, you know, really fancy stereoscopic visuals, so we're scared off. I don't see that.
It's not like the good RPGs on DS were cheaply made, though. It's not like they're among the worst-looking DS games. Absolutely not true. You know, no. Radiant Historia has very nice sprite work. You've got Dragon Quest IX and Final Fantasy IV, which are among the best-looking polygonal games on the whole library. So, yeah, those games were cheaper to make than they were on than they would have been for a console, but I don't think they were slumming it either. I think no expense was spared on Dragon Quest IX, and maybe that's an outlier.
Yeah, right. I mean, they knew they were going to sell millions and millions of copies of that game.
Yeah, but something like Mario and Luigi Bowser's Inside Story looks absolutely beautiful, but it's all 2D.
I think that's the best looking game on the system.
There's an argument, sure. There's an argument to be made.
I mean, that's Nintendo.
Radiant Historia is a game that would be very lucky to sell 250,000 copies worldwide, but it doesn't look cheap. Mm-hmm. By any means. It looks very good.
It doesn't push the limits of the hardware either.
No.
I guess that's the thing, though. When you kind of scale up with the hardware, the one thing is that it probably is more difficult to give something a kind of classy look that is not expensive.
Right.
You know, like that's something that you can kind of do on DS with just know-how and love and attention to detail that, you know, once you kind of scale up to more powerful hardware is more difficult to pull off. But there is a proven market for people to play these kinds of games on portable devices, and the fact that they're more powerful is not going to scare them away. And also, don't forget that in Japan, they're used to paying higher prices for portable RPGs already. Yeah, stuff like DQ9 and all, they already were charged a premium over there. You know, like in Europe and America, maybe the higher pricing of those games might hurt them a little bit, but in Japan, I don't think it's going to be a factor either.
Well, there are two points worth making, though. Even if the cost of development goes up for these handheld games, it still isn't going to be commensurate with developing on the next set of systems.
Right.
So even if cost is a major factor, it's still by a noticeable difference will be cheaper to develop a 3DS game than a Wii or Project Cafe game. And ultimately, I think when you put out a game on the 360 or the PS3, you really can't get away with not slumming it, making an attractive game, but not pushing the hardware. I think people expect you to really push what you're doing. You couldn't do like a pretty 2D sprite work game on 360.
I think some of it is because there's a certain level now of proficiency with RPGs on a portable. You almost have to justify, okay, well, why do I want to sit down in front of the TV to play this one? And, you know, if it's something like Final Fantasy 13 that's got unbelievable amounts of money and time and effort gone into the visuals and the cinematics, then maybe that case can be made. But for a lot of developers, they would struggle to manage that.
Right.
And it's the level that Final Fantasy 13 takes it to is so unnecessary because...
But it almost has to be because Square set that bar so high for themselves every time.
They set it high for themselves. They haven't set it for every other developer and
publisher, but if they fail to meet that bar, they'll let down their own fan base.
It's just so silly. I mean, having completed Final Fantasy 13, there are moments where the graphics are really awe-inspiring and super impressive, but the reason I played that game for so long is because I like the gameplay, and to some extent, I like the story. But the amount of money that they spent on polishing up the graphics and doing all these ridiculous cutscenes really is kind of wasted on me. I want to play an RPG, and I was happy to play RPGs when they were called Dragon Warrior, and they look like shit.
Well, I mean, it goes back to when I discussed what they did with The Last Remnant, where they basically pushed the engine as hard as it could, and it killed Xboxes.
That's not pushing the engine as far as it's good. That's called buggy programming.
That's well, cool, no, but it's no, pushing it beyond.
No, I mean, it was the engine really couldn't handle what they were trying to do with it, and it polygons couldn't load fast enough for the game to display them.
Well, maybe they should have scaled it back.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the point. They felt like they had to push the hardware to
yeah,
the
I mean, whether this whether it's a sort of misplaced kind of assumption, you know, that they do have to do that, it may be misplaced, but I think the underpinning thing that gets us to that point is that they probably do feel like, right, this is a console thing, so this has got to be, it's got to be a much more lavish, extravagant kind of experience than portable, because you've got to justify it with something, and this is what they've justified it with now. You know, whether that was a good move or not is another thing
right.
entirely.
I mean, in that case, when everybody's face is finally loaded into the cutscenes because they didn't load before the cutscenes started.
Horrifying. The game,
creepy.
The game was stunning.
Well, you know, that's that one game's weird faults. But
I mean, it's if they weren't trying to push the system beyond its technical limits.
Yeah, well, I mean,
they're pushing their engine beyond its technical limits.
Well, it wasn't
the
even their engine. I mean, they licensed the engine out.
It's Square Enix having severely misplaced priorities. But the framework of Isaac's question is sort of, or the, you know, the scenario that he postulates is that JRPGs have sort of been disappearing, and the handhelds are immune to that because of the lower development costs, and he's concerned now that the development cost for the new handhelds is going up, so he's afraid that that's going to happen on the handhelds too. I think your premise is incorrect. I think that the number of JRPGs being made and released and localized has not gone down. I think it's actually gone up in the past 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. It's just that most of them have migrated to the handhelds. I mean, if you go back to Game Boy, Game Boy Color, even GBA did not have the RPGs that we see on DS and PSP now. Did not have nearly the number or the quality of them. Those games that we used to play on Super Nintendo and PlayStation 1 and GameCube maybe, but more PlayStation 2, almost all of those franchises and the developers that made those games are just making them for handhelds now, whereas they weren't before. So I think if you're worried about the genre drying up, forget it. It's going, it's very, very strong right now. I think it's sad that we don't have console RPGs too, because I would like to have that, because I grew up on console RPGs, but the genre itself is thriving, and it's just that it's on handhelds. So as long as you're okay playing Japanese RPGs on handhelds, you're going to be very satisfied for the foreseeable future, I think. James has the next letter.
So Mike from Waukesha, Wisconsin writes, "Very recently my dog had to be put to sleep. Between throwing myself into finals preparation and being understandably upset, I found myself booting up Wind Waker and simply sailing around aimlessly. Something inherent in that game, be it the art style, the music, or the simple feel of discovery and adventure, wraps around me like a warm blanket no matter how bad I feel. I found myself wondering if any of you have had a particular game that you have turned to in times of great stress or sadness. Thanks to everyone for all the great work." Mike, personally, I've been there. That really sucks.
Yeah, ditto. You know, actually, I think when my dog had to be put to sleep, and this was 10 years ago, it was horrible, and I'm pretty sure I played through Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, I mean, I think with me, a lot of it is always the music. I would play Super Nintendo games a lot that I like, just for the hell of it, just for the music, because it was soothing. You know, like Kakariko Village and A Link to the Past or something like that. But the thing is these days you can listen to the music separately, you know, through the miracle of radio trivia or other venues. So, I mean, I tend to just go to the music a lot more now rather than just like, let's boot up the game to experience it, you know, because that is, it's, I mean, it's just the act of a game being soothing, you know. I mean, there's not that many games that I would put in that category. I'm obviously something like Flower, which is very explicitly, that is its purpose, is to be a sort of soothing audiovisual experience. I mean, that's quite good.
I mean, I'm kind of the same with Greg in terms of the music being a big part of it. I've found that over the years, I've gone back to Mario 3 a lot, and it's sort of like comfort food for me because I know the levels and it's fun to play through them. I think it's kind of wearing off now. I'm getting older and played through it God knows how many times. But but certainly for a good portion of my life, Mario 3 was a go-to game.
I can't think of a game that other than I do think I played through Chrono Trigger for the umpteenth time that once. But I can't think of a game that I've gone to, anything else that I've gone to in a specific moment of need, but in terms of games that just bring me comfort, I think, you know, it has to be a game that you've played before, so there has to be a certain level of familiarity with it, that if it just, that maybe you don't need the comfort, but you play it and you feel that level of comfort. One for me is, Zero Mission, which is not that old. But it's a game I've played through so many times, and every time I do, it's just like sinking down into your favorite chair.
Mm-hmm.
It just wraps you, and you don't have to go anywhere. Like, I'm here, I feel good, I know what to do, I like doing it, and it's fun every time I do it. That's one I can definitely play over and over again, and I feel that sense of kind of warmth, you know, from going through it again.
For me, there's not a specific game in that respect.
Phantom Brave.
No. I mean, it's not a particularly stressful game. It's just particularly frustrating. I actually did play Wind Waker when last time I went through that. I watched a lot of TV that was more comfort TV shows. I've watched a lot of times over again because it's even less tactile. It's much more just zone out and you know, seeing how I digest games. It's not something I really have a lot of experience with besides Wind Waker, which I've played God knows how many times. And I think for me, it was actually the characters of Wind Waker that were more soothing because.
Like the kid with a snot bubble?
No. It focuses a lot on characters, like at least as much as Majora's Mask, if not more, because you're interacting with them so much instead of just stalking them.
You know, I have to say that, I mean, I had a lot of free time, I guess, when I was a kid or something, but I've probably played through Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask at least 5 times each. So there's got to be something there, too.
Yeah, well, I think Zelda soundtracks in general are very relaxing.
But to me, it was getting to, like, what's the island with all the bird people on it?
Oh, Dragon Roost.
Yeah, it was getting to Dragon Roost and seeing the characters there, just where I expected them to be, you know?
Because they always stand in the same place.
Well, I mean, getting there the first time playing the game, it's like seeing somebody you haven't seen in a while. There was something relaxing about that.
I guess there's a big difference, though, between something like Majora's Mask and Wind Waker from the point of view that Wind Waker is you know, it's got a certain amount of melancholy stuff in it, but it's quite upbeat and, you know, whimsical and all that.
Whereas Majora's Mask
is melancholy. It's quite depressing.
The dude's father is dead and in the closet.
Well, no, all the forms you take on are dead people.
Oh, yeah. It's very creepy.
And you're coming to terms with their ghosts and everything. And then, like what you said, Greg, about the music, I don't think that applies to Majora's Mask because the soundtrack's pretty creepy.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's
game.
More dark. Yeah, and that's Majora's Mask is not as soothing. There's a lot of, like, all the overworld parts where you go to when they're sort of poisoned, if you will. You know, each one is poisoned in their own way. Like, it's kind of like a mysterious, ominous kind of, sort, you know, it's not, yeah. It isn't the same as the other ones. It's about the apocalypse that's about
to
happen.
Right, and there's a much more reliance from a musical standpoint on things like minor keys and clashing note tones.
A lot of dissonance, actually. Yeah,
versus the other games where there isn't very much dissonance at all in any of the music.
So it's that one, I mean, that depends on what do you draw comfort from.
Right. Some people watch horror movies when they
do you draw comfort from listening to, like, I don't know, some upbeat pop song by Katy Perry or something, or by listening to Radiohead, you know, like that?
Yeah, Dark Side of the Moon for me is probably one that I would go to immediately.
I said I watch TV. I was watching caper films and caper movies because for me, there's just something. I mean, they're silly, they're ridiculous, but you can still zone out on them.
So the next letter is from Tom in Rochester, New York. Did I say that right, Greg?
I assume it, when I listen to the local sports radio in there, because it's Bill's country, they say Rochester.
Yes, okay. Because that is how it's said.
It's not Rochester.
It's not Boston. Not Rochester.
Rochester.
Rochester. Anyway, Tom is also known as Must Be Bert on the forums. And he writes, first off, thanks for all the time you guys put into the podcast. It does not go unappreciated. I look forward to listening to every single week. I feel like you guys are the spokespeople for us in our late 20s / early 30s.
/ early 40s, John.
I knew you were going there.
I was thinking about going 60s, but I figured that might be a bit extravagant.
So one of the Project Cafe rumors slash features that most interests me is backwards compatibility with GameCube. This may seem odd, but my current video game library is split between Wii and GameCube games. I never owned a GameCube, so I have been loving the opportunity to catch up on some of the titles I missed over the years. The current rumor is that the Wii's successor may be backwards compatible with GameCube. However, the other side of the debate that has been brought up on RFN is that Nintendo may choose not to include GameCube backwards compatibility in order to sell those games via the Virtual Console. Once Nintendo's home console is released, I will most likely sell my Wii, as I do not want to own more than one console at a time, and in turn lose half of my current library of games. My question for you all is, while I still own a Wii, what GameCube games should truly not be missed? Note, I do not enjoy first-person shooters or fighting games.
I like this guy.
Yeah, and also, you're all right with GameCube on that front,
yeah,
really.
Pretty much. Also, I would love to play a great RPG.
Bloody Roar, damn you.
That is a good one.
It is a good game.
Also, I would love to play a great RPG before I lose my GameCube compatibility. Thanks for the input. First up, man, Tom, why would you sell your Wii if the next system doesn't play Wii and GameCube games?
Because you'll get like $20 for it.
What do you? Yeah, you don't really gain anything from getting rid of it. And I'm really a believer in. I mean, I will trade in games if I don't like them or if I think I will never ever want to play them again. But trading in systems means that you lose the access to play all of the games on that system.
Yeah,
and you're probably not really getting much in return for it. So generally, I would say hang on to your systems.
I mean, the Wii's not very big. You can put it in storage if you.
Agree.
Seriously, yeah, it's tiny. It's like three DVDs.
I mean, it's the smallest thing in my entertainment center by far.
And especially if you're planning on, like, if, assuming that the next console has Wii backwards compatibility, I guess maybe they've even confirmed that. I'm not sure.
It's been kind of confirmed by the best source I have.
That you're going to still have all the controllers and crap that go along with that. And the GameCube controllers on top of that aren't that much. So unless you have like the DK bongos and all that other stuff. But my point is, it's not going to take that much more space to keep your Wii around just for GameCube.
Right. I can see them selling GameCube games for download while maintaining GameCube backwards compatibility.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, if they're gonna add GameCube to Virtual Console, which I think it's in their interest to do so, and I think they will do that if they can, then that means they also have to support all the controllers and everything for GameCube. So why not retain support for physical GameCube discs as well? I mean, the only downside is the disc motor is a little bit different, so it accepts the smaller discs, but I don't think that's a significant cost.
Right. I mean, the GameCube discs inherently are going to become more and more difficult to get a hold of as time goes on anyway. So they might not be losing out on that many sales to begin with.
Well, the reason they're not going to do that is because it's something Sony would or slash already has done.
Well, just taking it all as a given, though, Tom's policies on replacing consoles and what.
Well, let's discuss that list.
Yeah, well, Tom sent us a list of games he already has, which basically hits Mario hard.
He's got Mario and Star Wars.
Mario, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings.
I mean, he owns Bounty Hunter, so.
I own Bounty Hunter.
I can't do anything for this man on Star Wars.
One thing I did think, in terms of we had some Lord of the Rings games on there, is the Hobbit game.
Yeah, that's good.
You've mentioned on radio trivia and stuff in the past. I don't think it's necessarily meant to be like awesome or whatever. Maybe it doesn't quite qualify for the truly not to be missed or something. But if you like, you know, the Tolkien world, it could be worth looking at. Mm-hmm. But like I said, for me, RPGs, I really didn't play any on GameCube. So,
well,
James,
you aren't the only one because there aren't that many.
Well, I mean, ones I played and enjoyed on the GameCube, Tales of Symphonia.
Right.
Sure.
Baton Kaitos, either of them, really.
They're both really good games. I think 2's story is better, or 0, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah.
And the first game has more complex gameplay.
I want to say they're both a little bit hard to find now.
I wouldn't be surprised. I doubt they got. I know the second game got a small run.
I've got an unopened copy of the second one for Japan, if you're interested.
You're going to lose it because the story's the good part in that one.
I also own it in English. I played it.
Path of Radiance, obviously.
Yeah.
Fire Emblem, yeah.
Yeah. Sure. If you have somebody to play it with, Crystal Chronicles is amazing. If you don't, it's just good.
It's not really a straightforward RPG, but it's a really cool game. Definitely worth playing.
Same goes for Four Swords Adventures, although it really isn't an RPG.
Not an RPG at all, but it is a great action game that nobody's played.
Obviously, Skies of Arcadia is really good, although it's aged poorly.
Very hard to find also nowadays. Even when it was first released, it was a limited
run. I mean, I got mine, I pre-ordered mine, and I don't think I ever saw a copy of it in stores new again.
Yeah, Skies of Arcadia is very hard to play these days, which is too bad. It's probably easier to find on Dreamcast than it is on GameCube.
It looks pretty bad.
Yeah.
Visually, it hasn't aged well, but as far as the tone it has, it's kind of alone in that particular genre.
If the gameplay were a little snappier, I think it would be a better one to revisit.
I'd love for that game to be remade. Not remade. I'd love to have a sequel to it that kind of fixes a few issues, because it is a really compelling world.
Yeah. I would say it should pretty much go Symphonia, the two Kaitos games, which is kind of funny because they were all kind of made together.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can get it, Skies of Arcadia, and that should pretty much give you, you know, 3 or 4 months of RPG play right there.
Yeah, oh,
because
sure.
Those Baten Kaitos games are long. Tales of Symphonia is long.
Yes, it is.
And Skies of Arcadia Legends, if you find all the extra crap, is long.
But moving on from RPGs then, for me, as I alluded to earlier in the show, Beautiful Joe is one of my very favorite games on the GameCube that I think it's just, I absolutely love it. I love it. I mean, maybe it is hard. It could be something that drives you up the wall, maybe, if you're not like me. I don't know.
Yeah, can't see me grimacing right now. I own Beautiful Joe. I really tried to like it. I think I got through the whole game on easy. Of course, that isn't the whole game.
Is it one of those?
I'm pretty sure there are extra levels. And I just couldn't. I was not having fun replaying it on harder difficulties.
I enjoy it too, and the sequel. The fighting game you should avoid. It's not good.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Pikmin 2, because the first Pikmin, you can actually get it for the Wii. I'd say Pikmin 2 is a game that currently is only available on GameCube, and there's really nothing else like it. I mean, it's considerably different than even the first Pikmin. So it's really a unique game. That and Chibi-Robo, which is in a very similar boat. I mean, there is a Wii version that exists, but you're probably not going to be able to play it. So I would go find copies of Pikmin 2 and Chibi-Robo. Those are unique GameCube games that right now it's both kind of questionable whether those series are ever going to continue on consoles.
Well, if he's never played a Metal Gear game, if you can find the Twin Snakes, that's a pretty enjoyable experience.
Yeah, everybody, Metal Gear fans hate Twin Snakes. I think it's pretty good.
Well, yeah, I think it kind of got a little goofy for them.
It's super goofy, but then you play 4 and it's like, oh, well, this, it's not any worse.
Insane.
I mean, 4 ends with 2 70-year-old men having a fist fight for 15 minutes. I really don't think anything in Twin Snakes is that much crazier.
Well, shooting the Yoshi toy might be a little crazy.
Yoshi!
Twin Snakes is fine. I mean, I think that first Metal Gear Solid is not, I don't think it holds up as well as, say, 3, but it's still a good game. It's worth checking out if you haven't played it.
Prince of Persia 1 and 3 are good. Yeah. Avoid 2 because it's stupid.
Again, 3 is on the Wii, but the GameCube version is probably better.
It is definitively better.
And then we always talk about Jungle Beat being better on GameCube.
Oh, yeah.
So if you haven't picked up the Wii version already or something, you know, if you can find the bongos or you're willing to tolerate, it doesn't sound like Tom's terribly tolerant of clutter, apparently. But
no,
if he's willing to tolerate
not.
The bongos.
But I mean, at this point, they made so many bongos, they're essentially disposable.
Yeah, it's not hard to find bongos, surprisingly.
Yeah, just get them and get rid of them when you're done with the game or something, maybe. But I mean, that is one of the best games on the system.
If you like Mario games, you will love Jungle Beat. It's from the guys who made Mario Galaxy, so.
Yep, it's better with GameCube.
Before we proceed, I do want to make note, and I already told Tom about this to make sure he saw these features. We have two different features listing off some of the best GameCube games on the site. They're posted like around 2005, 2006. And one's called Lost Gems of the GameCube or lost GameCube gems. And they're basically a lot of GameCube games that you might have overlooked for whatever reason. Maybe they were obscure or just not well known, or maybe people kind of had misconceptions about them. It's a really cool feature, and it's very short write-ups. It's more just kind of a list, but a lot of games on there, some of the ones we've already mentioned, that are maybe not the most obvious picks, but they're definitely worth going to track down. So I would scroll through there and see if anything catches your eye. And then, of course, we have GameCube's Greatest Games, which was our basically generation-ending, be-all, end-all list of the absolute must-own GameCube-exclusive games. So, yeah, you should definitely go check out those features for a much more in-depth look at...
Yeah, and the I think F-Zero GX is on Hidden Gems, or maybe on both?
It's probably
I don't know,
but
F-Zero
both,
GX
actually.
I mean, the only game we mentioned that I know isn't on either of those lists is Baten Kaitos Origins.
Because it was so late, maybe?
Yeah, actually, it came out after the wrap-up feature. The wrap-up feature actually explicitly mentions it, saying, well, this game's not out yet, but keep an eye for it.
Well, Mike has the next question.
All right. Vic Blatz from Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada writes, see, I'm honorary John, apparently. Honored crew, you guys, not just you on the podcast, but all games journalists, were the reason that the 3DS was priced at a staggering $250 US. And you same perpetrators have the power to influence Project Colon Cafe's initial launch price.
Colon Cafe.
When you get your hands on it at the upcoming E3. So please do us a favor and don't slobber all over it. Get it weak in the knees and tell Nintendo reps you'd be willing to pay at least 400 big ones for like many, many gaming journalists did with regards to the 3DS. You idiots know who you are, and for shame.
So my first thing I'm going to do before I even touch it is go up to our Nintendo PR up and go, charge $8,000 for this.
Okay, so I suggest you people lowball what you would be willing to pay when you inevitably asked about it at E3, if not for yourselves, then for the sake of all your loyal listeners and readers. With great power comes great responsibility. So don't let Uncle Ben get shot again like you jokers did with the 3DS launch price.
All right, so to be fair, no Nintendo rep ever asked me, how much would you pay for
this?
No
one asked anyone. I think that...
They just gauged the reaction. The reaction was, oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, and also, I mean, you might have had like sort of an analyst like Pachter at this saying, I think they could charge $300 for this.
Well, that would mean they could charge $80 for it because he's always wrong. He's the worst analyst at anything ever.
He's making
ever.
A judgment about what the market can bear as a price. Mm. You know, he's not reflecting the opinions of any of the journalists that are there.
Right.
Yeah, I think when Nintendo talks about, you know, we showed this to people and they thought, and Reggie actually did this at a talk at NOA.
He said it, yeah, explicitly.
Yeah,
like this
he said, we showed this to people and we asked them what they thought it should be priced at. And they said, $400, $350. He's talking about focus groups.
Yeah.
Focus testing. He's not talking about journalists. They don't ask us. They don't care what we think, okay?
But as James says, you know, they'll take the temperature of how warm the reception was and
right.
then say, you know, what does this tell us about what we could charge for it? So it probably had a role to play, but, you know, I don't think it's really beyond the capacities of the gaming press to act terribly sort of blasé and snarky and unimpressed by things. So, I mean, this as a request from Vic will presumably be easily fulfilled, I think.
Mm-hmm. The fundamental flaw with this request is that it's asking journalists who are, if they're doing their job, giving their honest opinion and conveying it online or in magazines or wherever they cover this, he's asking them to basically lie and pretend like they don't care about something
well,
if it's really
Vic's,
good.
Vic's being tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah,
I mean, he's
I understand.
Trying to make a point
right.
here. But I think if you look at the way things go with gaming press, even back to, let's say, 2006 when the Wii was shown, with the first games were actually shown, everybody loved it.
Oh, the stampedes.
Well, even journalists. I mean, even people who now, you know, we get a lot of people asking, you know, why don't they ever talk about Wii games on other podcasts and other websites and things like that? Those same people who have totally written off the Wii and they talk about how they haven't played it in 3 years, they were crazy over it at E3 2006 because it was the new big thing. And look, this is not really a problem with us. It's an issue with how Nintendo designs their systems. And with Wii and 3DS both had these very gimmicky, flashy features that we'd never seen before, and we didn't really understand how they would affect gameplay in the long term. And so when you first see it, it's so different and weird that everybody's talking about it. It's designed to create buzz, and that's right. What it's going to do. And it's not that we were slobbering all over it. We were talking about it. And I say we in the very general sense, because obviously we're going to talk about it because we're a Nintendo site. But everybody was talking about the Wii and the 3DS because that's how Nintendo designed the systems.
Right. I've been to two E3s. E3 09, the biggest hum that I caught was the fact you could do keyboard cat scribble knots. But but at E3
very similar thing, actually.
at E3 2010, I mean, it was just this drone that was up in this citadel over there in the Nintendo booth is the salvation of gaming. I mean, and you could hear it everywhere on the show floor. It's at some point you would hear someone talking about it.
It was by far the most interesting thing last year.
Right. I mean, it was basically up there screaming at everyone else, just drowning everything out.
Yeah.
And it's inevitable that that's going to dominate the hype train. And it's as if Nintendo's the only people showing off new hardware this year, it's inevitable it's going to happen again.
Mm-hmm. And when they gather all these reactions from all the people who are playing it, about 10% of those will be from actual people in the gaming press.
Right.
Because E3, I hate to break it to you people, is basically open to the public. I know it's technically not, but that's a technicality. It's not that hard to get into E3, and most of the people who are there have no business being there, and they're not members of the gaming press, and they're the people who don't know what they're talking about, who are going when they see this new shit.
Well, I think a few of us,
they're the reason there are long lines. If E3 was for the media, there wouldn't be any lines, okay? So when there's a 4-hour wait to play 3DS, that's not our fault. And when people are going crazy about it, Nintendo's picking up all these ridiculous comments, that's not our fault. You can't blame me. You can go back and listen, and I'm worried about eye strain, and my brain can't process it, and how is this going to work into the gameplay, if at all, and it's really cool, but is it going to be kind of expensive because nobody's ever done this before?
I think it's also worth remembering some of the more fundamental and important things that are probably going into Nintendo's pricing policies, like the currency fluctuations.
Right.
Which, you know, they blame a big part for the falls in profits that they've seen in recent times, the last couple of fiscal years, actually, because the yen is appreciated against the dollar, all the revenue they get from America is worth less.
My money's worth more now.
Under normal circumstances, your money appreciating is good, but not when your company is heavily leveraged on international
sales. Yeah, it's
like
75% of their revenue comes from outside Japan.
That's a problem.
But interestingly, if we look at it, the $250 price, is not as high as it might have been given that fact, because in Japan, the yen equivalent is actually $300.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I mean, it's not like they took the positive reaction from E3 and took that as a justification to actually do a direct yen to dollar conversion, which they might have wanted to do to kind of claw back those currency losses, but they still had to accept that 300 is just, they thought it was too much for the American market to bear. So, I mean, you say staggering 250, but Pachter was saying it could be 300.
Sure.
Yen to dollar wise, it could have been 300. It's 250 is not that staggering by that yardstick.
I don't think 3DS is overpriced. I think it's expensive. Those are two different things. I mean, I think the technology in it is impressive, and it does things that no other piece of electronics that you own does. And it's going to have games that aren't going to be available anywhere else. But, I don't think the 3DS is overpriced. I think it would sell a lot more if the price was lower, but that may not be feasible.
Because the breakdown on the components suggests that the cost of it is like a $100 or something. You know, but that excludes, you know, a whole bunch of things.
That excludes,
you know,
like manufacturing and markup and advertising.
Well, and also tons of marketing and R&D. I mean, the R&D years of developing this 3D technology and figuring out how to scale it for the system. All that stuff has to be amortized through unit sales as well.
But what we know is they will be making a profit on it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they always do. Whereas, you know, something like NGP, when that comes out,
They will invariably lose money on it.
They're pretty much a banker to lose money, which, you know, again, reinforce the perception that the 3DS price is high by comparison, you know, when NGP does finally sort of make its debut.
It does everything, unless something happens to Sony's network again.
The NGP release is very good for 3DS market because competition forces everyone to be more efficient. And, you know, until NGP comes out, the 3DS is not going to drop price.
Right. I mean, the only thing the 3DS is competing against is the DS.
Well, and the iPhone.
Well, I mean, in terms of dedicated gaming handheld devices.
But the iPhone's expensive, too.
Well, I mean, in Japan, it's very much competing with PSP.
Right.
It's hella more expensive than PSP.
Yes, it is.
At this
point. It certainly is in that regard. But, I mean, with the cafe pricing, you know, console pricing, that's a whole other issue as well, because you know, the Wii now at this point is, you know, has come down.
It's at 150 officially.
It just went to 150 in the States, so
right, officially.
You could be talking about, you know, if they were to be the numbers that have been floated so far is like 350, 400. You know, is it that maybe, which I kind of struggle. I mean, I would have thought 300 would be kind of like their psychological barrier that they wouldn't want to cross.
Like, knowing nothing about the system itself, 300 is a hard cap because of Nintendo as a company. 300 is the absolute maximum they will sell a console for, and it could very well be lower than that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my thought. But I mean, if it was going to be 350 or something like that, with some of the indications have been, and you know, I mean, where the controller factors into this is another, you know, if they're going to be expensive because they've got screens in them, it's like, well, if you know, put the...
That may be where the real cost is. I mean, with Wii was a fairly inexpensive console when it launched, but the controllers were very expensive, and there were a lot of launch titles that encourage you to have four controllers. Yeah, and the nunchucks separately and the classic controllers, they made a mint on accessories.
Oh, and now you have to buy this stupid little dongle to go at the end if you want to play this game.
Yeah.
Screw you, Nintendo.
Yeah, they made a fortune selling controllers for the Wii, so I have no doubt that they're going to continue to do that with the new system.
But there again, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you have to take that into consideration to some extent as well. I mean, if the controllers are going to be pretty expensive, I don't, you know, that does put something of a limiting factor on how expensive you want to make the system itself, you know? I mean, because at the end of the day, people's budgets are what they are. I mean, you know, so far you can kind of take that con trick of like, well, you think you're spending this much, but you're going to end up spending that much.
Right.
I don't know. I'm going to predict a $300 system and $50 controllers.
Yeah, that's. I think you're in the right ballpark. They might go lower on one or higher on the other.
Right. I mean,
for Nintendo, I would not be surprised. I mean, a Wii Remote and Nunchuck was $60 in 2006. So a $60 or $70 controller, I do not think is out of the question. If they make it seem like it's worthwhile.
Right. I mean, they'd have to really sell it.
Sure. But they really sold it with the Wii.
Yeah, but they were separate transactions, though. So there's a certain psychological effect.
Well, that's that contract thing I was talking about. But I mean, but if it's like one thing with the screen in it and all that, I mean, that's going to be, well, look at the you could see the value because it's a screen in the controller, you know, and what they've got to do to make that sale is say that the sort of extravagance of having the screen in the controller is actually worth your time because of the kinds of games that it's going to make possible.
Just to set people's expectations, you will not get a price for this thing at this year's E3. Absolutely not. It's too early.
We're talking about it being a year away. Just, you know, as we brought up earlier with the currency fluctuation, it'd be ridiculous to peg yourself to a price now when the economic realities of that price a year from now might be completely different.
Yeah, so, but one thing I do want to note is that you can bet that Nintendo learned a few lessons from the 360 and PS3 launches. First off, there's no way in hell they're going to sell anything for $500 or $600. Because that was almost killed the PS3 right out of the gate. I mean, Sony is, through force of will and corporate backing, allowed that system to survive to a point where it actually made any kind of financial
but,
sense.
But I mean, it
for them.
Really hurt the company. Not just the division, the company.
Well, it took one of its most profitable divisions into one of its least profitable, you know, biggest loss-making.
It's anti-profitable divisions.
Nintendo's not about to go down that route.
And they don't have divisions to sell.
And, you know, Xbox launched at $300 and $400. $300 for the core and $400 for the premium, which was the real, you know, the one that had the hard drive that kind of delivered on the promise. That was $400. And it's easy to forget now, but 360 had a very soft launch. It might have sold out the original shipment, but it was not lighting up the sales charts for the first couple of years until Halo 3 came out, and that was, what, 2007? That was 2 years later. Nintendo, as being a hardware company that makes a lot of their profit on hardware sales, they really can't afford to have that soft of a launch. So I think that really rules out a $400 price point, because they want this thing to be accessible.
Right, and they want it to burn, essentially.
Yeah, they want this thing to be popular right out of the gate.
I could see 350, but no higher.
N64 was, I want to say, 150 when it launched. GameCube was definitely 200. Wii was 250. I think this thing will be 300. I mean, you adjust for inflation, and the capabilities of the systems are increasing rapidly every generation. I think 300 is a very reasonable, safe type of number. I don't think anybody's going to bat an eye for Nintendo launching a home console at $300. It's not an unusual or unreasonable price. You go above that and people are like, why don't I just wait another year for the new Xbox that'll probably be even more powerful and cost, you know, $400 too.
That's sort of what happened to the Dreamcast.
Yeah. Not that Dreamcast was too expensive. Dreamcast, I know a lot of people are comparing this Nintendo's new system to the Dreamcast, and they're very, very, very different situations, but
let's not talk about the Dreamcast. let's pretend like we didn't have that part come up.
It was different in that the PS2 had basically already been announced by the time Dreamcast was launched.
Well, and Sega, I mean, if you look, Sega was like borrowing money to do the Dreamcast, basically. So,
yeah, it was an economic disaster.
Yeah, they were already in their own grave.
Nintendo's profits have not slumped nearly that much. Yeah.
Again, Sega was coming off the Saturn, Nintendo's coming off the Wii.
Yeah.
There's not much in common there.
But to be
all.
Fair, by the time the Wii successor launches in, you know, the second half of 2012 or whatever it's on course for, we might have heard something about those.
They could be announced. Yeah, they could be.
I mean, they've sort of intimated they have a target date. It's a couple years in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting, and I think Nintendo has to some extent, either future-proof or just skew their system. You know, they don't want to compete with those guys, right?
The biggest thing they need to do in terms of, well, how powerful is it going to be and what's going to give them air? Obviously, they're going to do something that's at least ostensibly innovative and it offers, you know, like different kinds of experiences. But the biggest thing they could do from a tech point of view is just make it as easy to develop for as possible.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
and
huge.
That seems to be a huge priority.
That's where
for them.
The effort's going to go in terms of the tech of the, you know, how this system is constructed.
If this thing doesn't run Unreal Engine 3, I'm going to slap somebody at Nintendo.
Is that your first question going to be for P-Rop? Does this run Unreal Engine 3? I don't know what that is. Smack.
It may not necessarily be appreciably more powerful than the other two systems currently, but it could be attractive if it offers, you know, by whatever means, a much easier development process. Mm-hmm. And both from the point of view of the inevitable ports that will arrive, you know, go from the current HD systems, or multi-platform versions or whatever, but also, you know, original stuff as well. It's just got to be easy to develop for.
Maybe we'll have Mass Effect 3 as a launch title. The improved version of it.
The problem with the easy to develop for a statement is that Nintendo thought they were making a console that was easy to develop for with the Wii. And for some people it was. And so I think what you're really going for is it's good for portability for cross-platform development.
Yes, that's very important.
Well, what's funny though is that because of the Wii and the Xbox have a sort of, or the 360, not the original Xbox, have a sort of common lineage going on their hardware specs and their hardware architecture. Really, this is stepped up, I mean, greatly stepped up Wii architecture, but also slightly stepped up Xbox architecture. Mm-hmm. So they could say, well, it's not dissimilar from what you have experience on Wii, which a lot of developers have now. And it's also very similar to your 360 experiences, which they also have. Right. So it should be a much more familiar equation for them.
Yep.
Versus before, like, hey, it's like that system we never made any games for, you bastards.
All right. Well, it's time to move on. So the final email today is actually not an email. I got this from Facebook. So if you post...
That's cheating.
No, I mean, people post all kinds of things on our Facebook page. If you post a question that is, you know, that applies to the whole group, then I may read it on the show just like an email. So this one was from Chris, who wrote, I know an email would have been nicer, but I just wanted to let you guys know how much of a fantastic job you guys have been doing. I enjoy the show very much, and it helps me focus while I study, do chores around the house, and while I'm stuck in traffic coming home from school/work. Really enjoy your podcast, and I was curious if you recommend any other ones. Which gaming podcast do you guys listen to, and which ones do you recommend? Now, this is a question that comes up about once a year. John mentioned that he doesn't actually listen to any other gaming podcast. Probably
any other podcast, period.
Doesn't even listen to this one.
He never got on that MP3 thing.
Yeah, we haven't developed a way for podcasts to be playable on gramophones yet or whatever.
I was going to go on Slabs of Rock, but I'm glad you went there.
Yeah, I thought I'd preempt you.
Since John's not on the show this week, I thought it would be a good time to ask this. Maybe Mike can throw something in the ring here.
I actually don't listen to that many podcasts either.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, obviously, in reality, it goes without saying, but we won't pass up the opportunity to mention the Radio Trivia.
Right,
and the newscast, our other podcasts, yes. Here. But, you know, my appetite for podcasts is not quite what it was for whatever, for reasons I don't understand, really.
Really?
No, I don't.
I would say, I would guess editing plays a major role in it.
I've been editing for 2.5 years. It's that.
Oh, I mean, I don't know what the time frame of it decreasing
that,
you're talking about.
That is not a variable, shall we say. But for me, a relatively new one that's worth looking into is the 8 Foreplay podcast, which is Mark McDonald, who works with 8 Four as a localization firm in Japan. So, you know, obviously it's looking at the Japanese scene.
Well, sort of.
It's not exclusively. You will hear a lot more about Monster Hunter on that show than you will pretty much anywhere else.
For sure. Yeah. I think the one criticism I have of 8-4 is that they spend almost too much time talking about what's going on out in America. And it's like, you know, and people probably think the same thing when we talk about PlayStation and Xbox games. But it's just like, you guys have a niche that's really interesting. I wish you would focus a little more on that, because sometimes, but that, I will say that their episodes where they talked about the earthquakes were really, really interesting, and they do have some really cool ones. They recently did an interview with a guy who used to do localization for Square Enix in America, and that's fascinating stuff. But, you know, we have the Famicast, which is sort of done sporadically, but I think they do just as good of a job as 8-4 in talking about the Japan topic, so I hope the Famicast guys will keep doing that, because I'd like to hear more of that. So, Mike, you listen to Retronauts, though, don't you?
I listen to Retronauts a little. We talked about that a little bit already, but they're doing a dial-in thing now, which I think is hit or miss. But, you know, I'd say for Retronauts, your mileage will vary based on a combination of who happens to be on the panel for any given episode, as well as the topic at hand. And they're pretty good about identifying the topics in their abstracts and the like. So,
the big thing is, if Chris hasn't listened to Retronauts before, you've got the backlog of the old school episodes.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, you could just look through and say, okay, which franchises do I fancy listening to them talk for like 90 minutes? And just, you know, maybe it's a franchise you intimately know, or maybe it's something you know nothing about but you're intrigued by. But, you know, you could just pick it out. That's great for something, you know, not like joining it now, but dipping into the backlog, and you can listen to the new call-in format as well.
Yeah, that show by its own definition really doesn't go out of style. It doesn't go out of date.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good shows. I listen to a bunch, but James, what do you have any that you?
No, I mean, I primarily don't listen to gaming. I listen to a lot of podcasts at work, but mostly it's just various ESPN podcasts because they have an app that lets me stream them. I mean, it's incredibly convenient because their app, I just say, I'm going to listen to this day's podcast for this show, and it just starts playing.
The sports podcast, the Rich Eisen podcast was really good during the season. He's very funny. He's very gifted sportscaster. But you know, we're probably not going to have a season for the next.
So let's talk about other things.
With games podcasts, I do listen to fewer of them now than I did before. I mean, obviously, like, what happened to One Up Yours, it didn't help.
Right. No. Those were sad days.
They got
days.
One Up Yours, man.
I really wish John Davison was doing something right now, because he's running, like, GameSpot these days. Mm-hmm. I guess he doesn't have time to... Is he running Metacritic as well?
They're owned by the same company.
Yeah, you see, so. I think he's, like, presides over both of them. But the point is, I mean, I think he's just too busy to do podcasts regularly.
It's too bad. He's a legend. I mean, he's really good.
He did
good.
Like, you know, What They Play. He did like a podcast for What They Play that I listened to, even though it's not aimed at me at all. I just found him soothing.
So this is tough for me because there's so many. I mean, I'm on more podcasts than most people subscribe to. But
cocky bastard.
I'm not cocky. It's just a fact. I'm on so freaking many podcasts. That most people just don't have the appetite that I do. I listen to so many, I'm going to forget half of them, and I don't have my iTunes open right now, so I could list them off. But off the top of my head, of course, all three of the ones here at NWR. So if you don't already listen to the Newscast and Radio Trivia, you should definitely do that. And then the Famicast, for now at least, is coming on our feed, so you'll get those anyway.
It's coming in your ear if you want it or not.
I hope so. But I listen to Weekend Confirmed for sure, which is Garnett Lee's sort of post One Up podcast, which is pretty good. And you'll hear Billy over there. He's a frequent guest. He's on there, I'd say, one out of four shows, maybe. So, and sometimes he'll be on for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. But, and then Jeff Cannata's on that show too, and he's a really interesting guy. I watch the Totally Rad Show, which is a video podcast, but I get that every day. So I like those. I get the only One Up one that I still listen to is Retronauts. I love the Giant Bombcast. It's not everybody's cup of tea, and I recommend it to people, and about half the people I recommend it to come back and say, "Whoa, why do you like that?" So
it never
strokes.
Stuck with me. I listened to several episodes, but just didn't. I guess I just didn't. The humor didn't click with me. It didn't happen.
I listened to 8-4 Play. That might be that's probably the bulk of my gaming podcast. And I listen to a ton of other podcasts, but I won't get into that. One other one that I want to recommend, I just discovered recently, is called This Year Collection. It's done by a guy who is a big fan of podcasts in general, including gaming podcasts. And he goes back to, like, say, 2005, 2006, 2007, and he goes through all the old episodes and kind of picks out clips and puts them together in one giant sort of summary podcast. So if you subscribe to this, you'll get things like the best of the year 2005 Hotspot podcast, which was GameSpot's thing. It was Jeff Gerstmann's first podcast. He's on there with a few other people. Alex Navarro's on there, and it's really cool blast from the past, and I wasn't listening to that show back then, so it's all new to me, even though it's old content, and it's produced very well, it's edited together. And if you desperately need, like, just quantities of podcasts, like, I have a boring ass job and I need something that will last me all day long, these are great because they're like 6 hours long. That's part A. Then part B is 5 hours long. So if you have a ton of time on your hands and you love listening to really long podcasts, check out This Year Collection. They've done One Up Yours, The Hot Spot. I think they're going to do a couple other gaming podcasts soon, and I'm lobbying for them to do Radio Free Nintendo, because I think, you know, we're coming up on 5 years and 250 episodes. We've got a lot of back material to go through, and a lot of it I haven't heard in ages, and there's just so much of it that it's hard to go back through. So, having somebody do that, sort of pulling out the best of each year, would be pretty awesome. So hopefully he'll do that, but in any case, it's great. I mean, you can go back and listen to all these. I listen to these clips of One Up Yours from 2006, which is the year I discovered podcasts, and they were so nostalgic for me, and so interesting, and still so funny to listen to. So I would definitely recommend that. It's not in iTunes, but if you Google This Year Collection, you'll find it, and you can subscribe manually through that. All right. Well, thanks everybody for the emails. We're going to have to wrap up the show now. Once again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And if we haven't gotten your email yet, keep listening. We might catch up on it. Otherwise, send in a new one when you get a chance, and we'll try to get to that one because we are getting a lot of them. So I apologize if we don't get to read your question on the show. We did see it. We do read everything that we get. So we've got a retroactive poll that is just a few days away from expiring by the time you get this. So the voting ends on Thursday, the Thursday after the show's out. I can't remember the actual date, but you will know what it is, and we'll take the answer from that and announce it on next week's episode. So if you haven't voted yet, please go do that. The results are very interesting so far, but there's plenty of time left to vote, so things could swing wildly. So again, the topic is games that have been remade recently, and your choices on that are Perfect Dark, Banjo-Tooie, Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, and Beyond Good and Evil, all really good, interesting games. So we're going to be talking about one of those on the show soon, and you can help decide which one it is if you go over and vote at the website. Finally, Mike.
Yes.
Would you like to plug your show?
Again?
Your excellent show.
Yes, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. It's supposed to be every other week, but really it's kind of like once a month now. I've gotten very busy. But I'm working on the latest episode. I recorded an episode with Zach Miller. And as a little bit of a teaser, at least one of the games mentioned on this podcast is used.
Oh.
So find out which one.
Dozens of choices.
Exactly.
It's really fun. I mean, it's like half music, half talking. And and it's like a game built into it. So you play along at home.
I have a guess.
It's awesome.
But now I have to listen. Damn you.
James can name that game in -1 song. All right. That's all for the show. Mike, thank you so much for doing this on short notice. And we look forward to having John back next week. And, of course, Greg and James should be back as well. So we'll be back next time right here on RFN.
Bye-bye.
By the way, Johnny, to answer your question, the worst game title of all time is Lee Trevino Fighting Golf.
You know, I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, there was the Outlaw Golf game a few years ago that was a travesty. But as Greg was discussing Tiger Woods, the Masters, and you know, we all know about Tiger's personal problems.
Indiscretions,
sure. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if next year, if EA just embraced the whole thing and it was like Tiger Woods and the Bad Boys of Golf, and it was like him on the cover with Colin Montgomery and like
John Daly with like a huge foot long in his mouth.
But John Daly already has his own golf game. That's the best part.
Charles Barkley, and then next to him,
he's going to gamble on the game? He can't play.
And then instead of Jack Nicklaus, we'll have Jack Nicholson with a cigar in his mouth. And they'll all just be like throwing a middle finger up to the viewer, and that's your cover for Tiger Woods 12.
Oh my god.
Bad Boys of Golf.
Yeah.
Warriors of Golf.
Warriors of Golf. Oh yeah, that's good.